So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review.
Started watching that Gillian Anderson show where she's the homicide detective. Too much.
Haven't seen that either.
Oh my god.
I'm behind on television.
Oh, it was a brutal, brutal show. It's on Netflix. Oh.
What's it called?
I can't remember what it's called, but it's Gillian Anderson show. And she's like were you a big X-Files guy?
No.
Oh, you said that with like a pain.
No, I didn't have anything against the show. I just
Because you and Wei were like the right age.
Yeah, it was big when I was growing up and stuff. I just didn't I didn't get into it. Just the science fiction deal, I was just, nah. It was also on Friday nights. I didn't know why it got so popular amongst, like, you know.
Well, let's be honest. Well, it was on Friday nights, and let's look at the demo that it got popular with. Like,
very
it wasn't
true.
Like, yeah, it was like, it's so weird. It's like all these frat boys were staying home on Friday nights and watching The X-Files. It's like, no, it was people like me and you.
Yeah,
I wasn't a big fan either. But
hey, to that,
I didn't mean to lump you in with me.
No, I mean I was a TGIF guy.
Oh yeah, Urkel.
Family Matters, Boy Meets World, Step by Step, Hanging with Mr. Cooper, 8 till 10 every Friday.
What do you think of the remake?
I haven't seen it yet.
No, I don't think it's aired. I think it has.
I think it started on Disney, hasn't it?
Oh really? I thought it was just like a theoretical. This is what's going to happen.
No. I think it's out.
Oh geez.
Girl Meets World.
Girl Meets World, that's what it's called.
Yeah.
Are you excited?
Topanga and I will watch it at some point. I just haven't gotten around to it now.
I never really got into that show either. I was too old.
No.
But I did, Vader was on it.
Vader was on it, that
and
is true.
Who was on it with Vader?
Oh, God, it was Jake Roberts?
Was it Jake Roberts? I don't know, because there's someone I was listening to a podcast the other week talking about it. Maybe it was Big Van Vader that I heard talking about it on a podcast.
Vader was definitely on it. Here. This is why we need to Google
the Google
show.
Machine.
The Twitter.
Do you listen to Jericho?
I listen to him on and off.
Yeah, me too.
Sometimes.
Yeah, I like
too much out there to try and keep track of.
There's a lot of content these days. You know, you guys were like first out of there, but you
what? Vader versus Jake the Snake on.
Oh, what's Jake the Snake? Look at that. You win on Boy Meets World trivia and wrestling trivia.
Ric Flair, Antonio Inoki, two of the greatest international superstars in a worldwide wrestling extravaganza. For the first time ever on pay-per-view, it's a spectacular one-time global event. Collision in Korea.
I'm so lonely. So lonely, so lonely and sad, real alone. There's no one, just me only, sitting on my little throne. I work very hard and make up great plans, but nobody listens, no one understands. Seems like no one takes me seriously.
Hello, everybody. It's John Pollock.
And I'm Wei Ting.
And this is Review of Damien. Hello, everyone.
Hey.
Damien, you have found your way back here to our beautiful studio.
I'm back here, and guess what, John? Unfortunately for you, I have time to spare today.
Oh, boy.
Unlike last time where I had to run away.
Well, we are, we're going to keep this one manageable.
Okay, I know.
It is a busy day.
It's a
busy day, but I'm going to carve out a good portion here for one Damien Abraham.
I feel bad because like it's like as busy as I was last time I was here, you're that busy today.
Here's what happened. I am not even going to put on the illusion that it is Wednesday morning that you're listening to a taped podcast. It's Monday right now.
It's Monday.
Very big story coming out of Sunday night involving TNA, Spike TV. So this was before that story came out, okay? My Monday was going to be hosting a half-hour show or five-round show on Fight Network, then doing our regular desk chat that we do every day. It's like a 10-minute segment. Then I'd have to watch the G1 because there was a show Monday in Sendai and do a podcast on that.
Which apparently was unbelievable, like the best show.
That's what I'm hearing. I've not seen it yet. Then do the show with you. And then, of course, got to update the site, do all that regular shit, and then do Review of Raw Monday night. That was what my Monday was shaping up to be. Then this story happened on top of that. So I have moved stuff around because there's only so many hours in the day that one man can possibly talk and do stuff. So now G1 came out on Tuesday. We've got podcasts with you right now. I got to do a bonus show with Court that is up at this point. I'm talking in the future tense when this is Wednesday, and you will already know what is up there on Monday. So go to the podcast section, and you'll know what I put up on one day, knowing the fact that this podcast was also recorded that day. I'm burning out.
Oh,
Damien,
my gosh.
I'm quickly burning out. I understand now.
I'm really excited to download Review of Raw tomorrow morning.
Oh, my goodness. I feel like it's the night after the Royal Rumble, and I'm going home. I'm going home.
You're
going
to go home.
And I'm not going to tweet, and I'm going to let the bags under my eyes just disappear, and then I'm going to go to Comic-Con next year and work for Nerdist.
You're definitely going to do that.
That's what I'm going to do.
You're going to have to get an all-scab edition of Review of Raw tonight. It's going to be Nate Milton, Brian, myself. Who else could be there?
Yeah, but by me leaving, who would become then the Daniel Bryan? Maybe you would be, complete with the beard. You would be the one the people want to see headline WrestleMania.
I don't know.
And headline Review away.
I think Nate Milton's more of a crowd favorite than Damien Abraham.
Oh,
of
perhaps.
The law community, the law fan base.
What was the last review we did? I'm trying to remember right now.
We did that Samoa Joe Necro Butcher show.
Oh, of course. Samoa Joe Necro Butcher. Still fresh in my mind.
Oh, that's such a great wrestling match. I showed it to more people on that tour that I have been on since those two times.
And what was their reaction? As non-fans just watching violence.
Well, we took this band called Weed on tour. Ironically, or I guess fittingly, none of them smoke weed.
Oh, so, that's kind
of
weird.
What a waste of a name. But they're an unbelievable band from Vancouver, but all of them are actually from America, weirdly, too, but based out of Vancouver. But anyway, so they were in the dressing room, and I decided to expose them to the high art that is the art of wrestling, and they were mortified.
You watch this stuff and get enjoyment out of it, you sick fuck?
I was just like, I actually just like, by this point, I'm more a connoisseur of the facial reactions of people watching the video. You know?
It is the two girls, one cup of wrestling.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I could never watch that because I'm like, it's going to be, like, kind of weird and creepy and, you know. But this is, like, you know, weird and creepy in a way I can handle.
At what point in, like, a newfound friendship do you feel you can bring out the deathmatch videotape? What point do you feel that, okay, you know what? It's time that we go to this next level and I pull out this YouTube clip.
Well, like, as long as it's, like, just a YouTube clip and you're not, like, there's never really a point in the relationship where you can unveil your DVD home video collection of deathmatches. Like, that's a point where you know. But knowing a crazy YouTube clip, we can all get away with that or two.
I remember the first...
You'll see that in the first conversation with me is what I'm trying to say to you, John.
I remember when me and my friend in high school, he ordered some tapes online, and one of them was like a deathmatch tape. And he was like, we got to watch this together. And I was like, all right. So I came over. I mean, this was like porn or something. We put it in, and it was some of the most violent stuff. And I was like 15, 16 at the time. I'm like... Dude, I don't even know if it's legal that you should be buying this online and it's delivered to you. Like, this is so great. They're like, there were scorpions, glass.
Yeah.
I'm like, what the fuck are we watching here? I mean, just so foreign to any professional wrestling that is your foundation when you go off the beaten path and suddenly there are, you know, scorpions inside of enclosed cases that guys are suplexed onto.
Well, there was like my friend Kai had that RF video, the world's bloodiest matches. And it had the Sabu injury where he tries to go through the table and hurts his back. And it had the Invader 3. I think Invader 3 gets jumped on, or maybe it's Invader 2, and starts coughing up blood. You ever seen that? The Puerto Rico?
Jose Gonzalez would be Invader 2.
Yeah.
Invader 1, actually.
Is Invader 1 that? I think Invader 1 runs out.
And it Invader...
was like, oh, is Invader 1 that he... And then like they swallowed blood.
Oh,
and,
right,
like,
right.
Ipecac to make it vomit out blood. Anyway, we watched this tape, and that's like... I was like, oh, my God, this is not WWF or WCW at all. And that was like a bridging thing. And also this guy Tony Erba from Cleveland, who played in the band Gordon Solie Motherfuckers. And,
yes.
And, you know, I've mentioned them on the show a bunch of times, who actually, after I was on MLW, he's like, dude, I heard you put me over to Conan. Like, yeah, because he was like a huge, huge fan of Azteca and all these old, like, you know, Lucha Libre promotion. So he loves Conan, right? So he's like, I can't believe that's the coolest. So that got me over with him. So in a roundabout way, John, you got me over with, like, my Elvis, Tony Erba.
Yes. And yeah. Look at this. MLW now starting to do some poaching here with some very frequent appearances of one Damian Abraham.
I don't see a ring on this finger until that day
there
comes.
There is a ring on that finger. Well, yeah, just not from us.
Yeah, not from
us. Big skull here on his middle finger.
Until someone gives me that LAW ring or that MLW ring, I don't have any allegiances. No.
The ultimate free agent in wrestling
I am
podcast.
The Matt Hardy of the wrestling podcast world.
It's okay. It means less guilt when I grabbed Alex Greenfield last week.
Yeah,
on
exactly.
The show.
Exactly.
So it's an extended family.
Yeah, Alex Greenfield and I are both so high that we exist in a plane where we can just be floating from show to show.
It's like those two universes of Care Bears, right?
Exactly.
Where they can go back and forth.
Exactly.
I don't know who would be Lionheart, but nonetheless.
Did you ever watch Voltron as a kid?
No, I did not.
Okay.
Never even heard of it.
No, Voltron was like, you never heard of Voltron?
No.
My God, John. It was like, it's like Power Rangers before Power Rangers type thing, but it was animated. And it was like a bunch of lions that would form together into this giant robot. But then there was this other Voltron where they were all cars and they would form together into a. This is wasted.
Rings a bell. I don't recall the name Voltron. Wade would probably be shaking his head at my lack of
knowledge. No, I'm going to say, I think it's once again those 6 years between us.
Yeah, that might be. That just falls into that.
Or 4 years now.
That 4 years difference? Is that our difference? I'm 30.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You just turned 30, so I'm 34.
Okay.
I still think of you as being 28, but I guess it's because you guys were talking about being 28 and having a joint birthday party.
Yeah, we've aged in the last 2 years.
Yeah, a little bit. Time just stands still for me. No one ages on iTunes, John. Those 4 years, it's amazing the cultural reference points that change. You know?
What were the main shows of choice when you were a kid? Because I had Today's Special was a big favorite
was a
of
big
mine.
And that was for me too, I think.
The department store?
Yep.
I think that was a
hurry, Jody, get there.
Oh, it was
I hope she makes
come
it
come on,
before.
Jody.
Get there. I hope she makes it before 9:99. I hope she makes it there on time.
If I can find that song, that's what we're going out with today. Fuck this punk shit. We're going out with Jody trying to pay the rent for the department store.
No, she had to show the certificate to show that it was a historical building, and it was in Muffy's house. All the American viewers are like, what the hell is wrong with Canada? All the listeners, I should say.
It was funny. The creator of Today's Special was one of our profs at Ryerson, actually. And I thought,
think you guys have talked about this on the show.
I think that was hurry, Jody, get there.
Yep.
We found it. Thank God for YouTube. Unbelievable. I wish I had speakers on this.
You're going to get a YouTube.
Jody races to save the department store as the gang sings for her to get to the manager's office on time.
Oh, how many views does this have?
16,453. Not one thumbs down. How could you?
No, how could you hate on this?
Today's Special. That was what were your shows?
I'm trying to think. Thundercats.
I remember that was just before me. Yeah. Like I knew that was a big thing, but just before my time.
I remember the day Thundercats aired for the first time, and afterwards calling my friend and discussing it, like having like an analytical discussion
about Thundercats.
A 6-year-old, it's like the song was really awesome, and he's like, "Yeah, the theme song was super awesome." And I'm like, "I like that guy Panther," and he's like, "Yeah, me too." And I totally have a very, very clear recollection of that conversation, but. Thundercats. Do you remember Mask?
Mask. I knew Mask.
There were the guys in the cars, and then the mask would come down, and the car would transform. I guess those were big ones for me. I'm trying to think.
I watched the old Batman series, the live action one.
Me too, me
too. That was a big favorite.
And Green Hornet was being re-aired at that point, too, so I'd watch some Green Hornet.
Right.
Wrestling. The wrestling cartoon that was on TV was a big one, too.
I missed that. That was like.
That was. I just got that. I was like, what was that, 84? 85-ish. Yeah, and I would have been like, that would have been right when
that
I
would
was
make
getting
sense.
Into
that would be right in that 4-year gap.
Yep. Looking at my, that's what I'm telling you, John. I got to experience so much stuff that you never got to see.
A 5-year-old Damian Abraham saying, one day I'll be talking about this shit in people's earbuds.
Exactly. That's why I should have invented the Walkman then when I first conceived it in my head.
For our fans out there, especially keeping it with the Canadian theme here, a lot of upheaval going on. With much music.
Yep.
This directly affects you and the Wedge. Tell us?
Well, I'm afraid wrestling fans, Law fans that followed the Wedge, after having CM Punk on the show, Chris Jericho on the show, Edge on the show, Dolph Ziggler on the show, there is no more show. They have canceled the Wedge. They laid off like a ton of people. I was one of those people. I never had a contract with Much Music ever, so I guess I was laid off, kind of. When you don't have a contract, it's kind of weird to be laid off, but I was. And so there is no more Wedge. But onwards and upwards, I'm doing like a documentary that comes up next week on Vice, on medical marijuana in Canada. And I'm doing another couple of a food show pilot that's coming out in the fall and stuff. So
you're a busy man.
Well, I just like, you know, in the band and stuff, but I'm going to miss the Wedge. I'm going to miss like my...
Will you miss much music?
I'm going to miss the Wedge. I'm going to miss people I worked there with.
Yeah.
But, you know, but like I think there's no...
What happened to the channel? And you're much more of an authority on this than I.
Well, I think the issue became there was a point where they started chasing a certain demographic, and that was a younger demographic, and that was a demographic that, you know, most of the older fans weren't a part of. And then so these older fans kind of checked out. And I think, you know, there's no more Much Music. It's now just called Much.
Yep.
And, you know, that kind of sums it up. You know, like there was a generation. It was one of those when the first rounds of cuts were announced and when they were switching from Much Music to Much, there was like a story that leaked in the paper about it. And they were quite upset that the story leaked in the paper. And I'm like, shouldn't you be upset that no one cared? You know, like they're, you know, like we should be really upset that no one cared. Like people should be freaking out, you know, mad about this. And that's how you know people are loyal to a brand. And I think it's just, you know, unfortunately the demo's changed and you know, our demo isn't that demo anymore.
Just going to angle this a little more.
Sorry, I
don't want the people to miss out.
Well, Levelator will fix that, right, John?
Levelator is a great toy. But it's not a miracle worker at times, as I've found in the past.
But yeah, so I think maybe we'll just cut that and come back with saying something a little
more. Me and Brian Mann learned that last week. Levelator cannot save everything.
I thought it was a great podcast. I love Brian on the show.
Hey, I enjoyed it too, and I was just fuming over the level problems, which is my fault. So
I just hit that mouse. Did I do anything bad?
Nope. We're still rolling.
Okay, sorry. I don't know. I just think it was, you know, the demographics changed and the people they're looking for an audience changed. Now, you know, it's people consume music videos differently than they did before. You know, like you're not going to sit through a video you don't like. You know, you're going to go to YouTube. And so the nature of music television has to change. And Much Music, I think, is saying, you know, they're going to go find something else for an audience. And unfortunately, the Wedge was not part of it, and so there's no more Wedge.
What do you think of Aux and how they're tackling things?
I think I watch that channel. I've always watched that channel. I think it's, you know, it's they're tackling it in the only way you can, which is like trying to find that audience that, you know, is a little older. You know, that was the audience of Much Music at a certain point that is now, you know, out there. You know, yeah. It's like it's one of those weird things. It's like, what happened to that Much audience? You know, theoretically, Aux should be able to just grab all these people, you know, but it's like the WCW audience. You know, it's like, what happened to those 5 million people that were watching wrestling that night that just turned off? You know, like or those millions of people that were watching wrestling still at the very end. You know,
it just seems that like it can be done. It can be successful. And it's just someone that I think needs a real unique way of how to present this in 2014 in such a way that's updated.
Well, you look at Pitchfork, you look at Noisy, like Vice and Noisy, like Noisy is Vice's music channel, right? They have millions of followers on Twitter. They have millions of page views, millions of subscribers on YouTube in the case of Vice, you know? And I think that's where media is kind of going in a lot of ways, is to those kind of like – instantaneous response. That's what people want now, is that instantaneous response, you know, and television is being used differently now.
I read one article, and not to blow smoke up your ass, but it was talking about the demise of Much Music and stating how the glimmer of hope was the Wedge and bringing back Damian Abraham to resurrect the brand of the Wedge. Like, you were looked at as the guy that, I mean, has a credibility amongst, I would paintbrushes, say, a jaded audience that wouldn't be your typical Much viewer in 2014, I think.
Yeah, some. I think the audience of music has changed, right? Like, you look at, you know, like...
Like, I would imagine you heard from a lot of people who would say, I enjoy you on The Wedge, but I don't watch anything else on the network.
Yeah, I would hear that.
Like, you had a very different show from what the tone of that channel
was. Yeah, I had a very different show than anyone will ever have ever again, including myself, because it became at the point where they just stopped... you know, not they. I shouldn't say they because I don't want to paint everyone with that brush. There were certain people at the station that loved the show and really championed the show and worked on the show and really went to bat for the show. And probably the reason the show stayed on the air in some way or another. But there were other people at the station that just didn't care and didn't even know that we were there. And that's why I think I could just show up and come up with the most insane episodes ever. Like I would like – there are plot lines. I became a character. I wrote other characters. I wrote management into a character on the show too and like lived out all my wrestling fantasies. Had Chris Jericho worked into an episode.
Yes.
You know, as a character on an episode, you know, and it's like – I look back on it. I have, you know, and I even said this to them in my exit interview. Like, I got to be a Much Music VJ for 3 years. Like, even if we were successful at it, I don't think you should have kept me around beyond 3 years because I think, you know, there should be someone new coming in there. Granted, it wasn't successful and they just did away with the position and there's not anyone being brought in to replace me in that kind of role. But I think I got to live out my fantasy and be a Much VJ. It's unfortunate that it didn't mean as much.
And meet us as a result of it.
Absolutely.
How would we have met if it wasn't for Much Music?
I got to meet you guys, you know? Like I got to meet CM Punk. I got to live out all these wrestling fantasies.
Isn't that funny that we met because me and Way were doing a segment on the street after the Punk angle.
Yep.
And here we are 3 years later, his contract, which he signed.
Just ended.
Right there. Ends.
Yeah, that was.
As does your run.
As does my run. I'm much like CM Punk. Unfortunately, I don't think you're going to be turning on Much Music to see a One Direction live in studio and hearing people chant, Damian, Damian,
oh,
Damian.
Yeah. Well, if your wife was an on-air character, maybe.
Every time my wife walks on screen, they chant, Damian, Damian. Unfortunately, my wife's not a VJ either. But
you know. You know what they would chant, though? If they were upset at management?
What?
You fucked up.
They would. I would hope that would happen. I would definitely. And that would also cause issues. Unfortunately, I was never, you know, I don't think, like, I got to be what I wanted to be, which is like the host of The Wedge and a VJ in the sense of what a VJ was in my imagination and what a VJ was in the 90s. I don't think I could fit in any other sort of structure there, you know, where I would be like interviewing high-profile artists and being like, these guys are awesome.
I would stay home every Friday night if you were doing the 30 countdown.
Well, did you see
up next is Justin Bieber.
The two episodes of the countdown that I did?
I haven't seen those.
One where they made me wear a shock collar and one that they made me a robot as a robot.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Those were the ones I wrote myself that were the ways that I could do it. And thankfully, there were only two because I ran out of ideas. And I got to admit, the robot one was nowhere near as good as the shock collar episode, which was the first one.
Oh, I wish I saw these.
I think they're PVR, John. You can come over one day.
saved on your TV.
In the Damian Ego file that is known as our PVR box.
Come on. It's Saturday morning.
You got to do it, kids. Come on.
We're doing the robot one today.
No Blue Jays until we watch Daddy play and play indie rock videos.
Do your kids understand that you're like like what you do
unemployed?
Being on TV, is that weird for them? Have they seen you on TV?
Well, no, they do watch The Wedge. Some of the episodes that I'm like, this is kind of inappropriate. But it's being on at 9:30 in the mornings on Sundays. You know, they could have watched it. They watched it. They were on a couple episodes. There was one episode where in storyline I lost Dorian, my youngest son, in the building.
Oh, I remember you tweeting about this.
Yeah. So I was chasing him around the building. Another episode, Holden was at a show with me and walked me to the stage, not in storyline, in real life, and we'd shot that. And there was another time where Dorian was at another show we played and was backstage, and so he was on. So they've been on the show, and I'm really happy to have those moments kind of saved because, you know, hopefully they look back on that and don't think, God, my dad exploited us as kids, and think instead,
no,
it was awesome that he put us on TV.
I would think it'd be cool.
Yeah, hopefully. But who knows? They could hate it.
Our man Wei Ting sent in a question, actually.
Oh, really?
He wanted to ask you about this photo.
The mangina.
The mangina that I joked to him. We were doing the logo for this week's show, and I was like, hey, Wei, because he photoshops. And I'm like, hey, Wei, I found a photo for you.
Have you ever looked?
He did not appreciate me sending this.
Look, if you look up Damian Mangina, there's another mangina photo where the whole band, that the NME used, where the whole band's pointing, holding me up. And the photographer's like, hold him up, adore him, he's your Christ. And Jonah.
I love all the photos in this article, like of all your.
I know, well, that's
the people
thing.
In your band, it's all these sophisticated photos. And then we get to Damien, and this is what they use for you. This is fantastic.
This was a noisy.
Look at this. This is so like artistic, these other profile shots.
So annoying. This is noisy Vice's music offshoot for this long format interview they did with us. They had a photographer, and the photographer didn't show up for my day or Mike's day or Josh's day. So those photos are of Jonah, Sandy, and Ben, who have the most like posed beautiful little photos. And then mine is me doing a mangina. That was from the when we played, I think, Renegade or Glastonbury in like 2007.
Wow.
So like, you know, it's years old. Years old. And that first one is from Gavin Watson photo session in 2009. Yeah, he's an amazing photographer. He did a book called Skinhead and did a lot of photography about skinheads, you know, both non-Nazi ones and so much sketchier ones too, but in the 80s and kind of got back to taking photographs again. So did that photo shoot with us. But yeah, that mangina photo, we played Leeds and Reading or I forget which one it was. I think it was the first one, which is Leeds. And I just decided – I'm going to tuck my penis between my legs and go.
This is the show to do it at.
I'll try it. I've done it a couple other shows just as like for like fun.
Kind of one will ever see this.
Well, doing the Buffalo Bill thing, you know. And at that point, it was like I'd be lying if I said it, I thought no one would ever see it because it was like a tent of thousands, tens of thousands of people but and a lot of photographers there. But to think that I would be still living with it this later on in my life, I never thought would be an issue. But yeah, that's – that mangina is a image that will haunt everyone. That's the second time Waze asked me about that, too.
Oh, really?
He sent me a text asking me about it.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe that
was... You wanted an on-air clarification about the mangina. But yeah, you guys should... you know, that should be the... you should crucify... Put me in the Austin crucifixion
As
pose.
People go to log on to fightnetwork.com, they already don't understand why we talk about pro wrestling on this thing. And this is the image that they get on a Wednesday morning. First thing in the morning as you're getting your coffee, and there's Damien Abraham.
It would be a knockout. It would be a knockout for sure, John.
You're going to Brazil for your next show.
Yes,
maybe,
I am.
Maybe you get a Brazilian and you...
get a Brazilian wax?
Yeah, and then introduce it.
I could.
In
I
Brazil?
Could.
Going to Sao Paulo?
Yeah, but after what happened to Jericho in Brazil, I'm not going to do anything.
Well, don't stomp on a flag.
Yeah, I'm not going to do anything that might get me in trouble.
Yeah. That could be bad times.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm not Jericho famous. I'm the type of famous that gets thrown in jail.
But think
not
about,
famous.
But think about what a great interview that would be next time you interview Jericho, and you both have that in common.
That's true. That would be awesome. It'd be we'd have that. I prefer we had more, you know, just like good hangs and friendship in common than share legal troubles. But, you know, I'll take it where I can get it with wrestlers, to be honest with you. Yeah, I'm going to Brazil to play a show with Dinosaur Jr. And it's going to be one of those, you know, weird experiences that I'm like.
Never been to Brazil.
Never been to Brazil. Dinosaur Jr. was like the first band I ever saw live, like that I went to myself kind of thing. At Massey Hall, I brought my little brother. My parents dropped me off. I saw Dinosaur Jr.
Wow.
It was like a real transformative kind of experience for me. I remember seeing Jay Mascis through this little window at Massey Hall, people from the backstage area, and I waved to him and he waved back. And he still remembers it to this day. No, he doesn't. but he sang on our new record and all this kind of stuff. So it's like it just feels like a really surreal kind of like cool moment to get to go there and play the show with them.
What kind of venue are you guys? Is it indoors, outdoors?
I think it's an indoor venue, but it's quite large. Uh-huh. I think it's like 4,000 people maybe, 5,000 people. I don't know. Dinosaur Jr.'s headlining, obviously, not us. But it's where I know Alexa on Fire played their last ever show was there. They were telling me – George was telling me the other day. So so there's like a little bit of lineage with our band too now.
Wow.
So we get to play on that stage. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And then I'm going to you know, buy some Brazilian hardcore records, learn some jiu-jitsu, and then hop on a plane and come back home.
All in 2 days.
All in 2 days.
The last time we had you on, it was the day before your big concert here in Toronto that we came out to see you.
That's
guys
right.
At.
That's right. What'd you guys do? Oh, yeah. We haven't talked since then.
Yeah.
Really.
I just remembered that right now. We haven't had you on since that concert.
That's right.
Yeah. You were on here. I don't think you could promote it ahead of time, could you?
No.
They had to announce it first.
I think we announced it. Didn't we announce? No, we didn't announce it on that show.
I think you were waiting for the venue
it.
To
Yeah, we were waiting for the official venue, sorry, to announce it. Yeah. But we, we played that show. We went on tour right after down in the United States and stuff. You know, started, but yeah, came back and all that stuff. It's been a little bit since I was on the show. So yeah, you guys came up to a show.
I came up and I was like, excuse me, I'm a really big fan. And Damien just turns around, oh, thanks, man. And it was like, it was a solid like 3 seconds before I connected the dots that it was me.
Well, at that point, John, I was in show mode, which means super stoned, heading to the stage, running to the stage, just about to play, catching the end of shit set and stuff. So I was not expecting John to be the last guy to grab me. I thought you would be up there moshing up front to shit. That's why I was surprised.
Oh, we were trying. It was just, it was really packed. Like, it was a packed.
It was a packed show.
Packed show.
Which is awesome to get to be there and play a packed show, because the first time that we played there 13 years before, it was sadly not very packed, so this was like a return.
I really enjoyed, like, in between songs, just like your history lessons and just all the knowledge that you were just right down to Adam Copeland out of Orangeville, Ontario.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and did we even talk about that on the last show when Fine Local Chuckle and Edge?
I think you have mentioned this before. Okay. But yeah, you brought that up for everybody. Yeah. Five Knuckle Chuckle and Edge out of Orangeville, Ontario.
Had to. And also, did we talk about Ziggler coming on the Wedge last time?
No.
I had Dolph Ziggler on we show up. So we have, one of our producers there who liked the show, Mike, was like, hey, just so you know, Dolph Ziggler's in town doing press. If you want, we can try and get you an interview. And I'm like, absolutely. So they get us an interview. It's at like Grant House or one of those private clubs downtown. We can't get a camera guy. By the time we get a camera guy, we get in there. And you could tell they were just packing up and leaving. And so we burst into the room with a camera guy and I'm there. And just the look on Dolph Ziggler's face was like, you fucking assholes. You dicks. Like, such hatred. Such hatred in his eyes for us. And it's like, oh, they're like, well, we're just wrapping up. And Dolph's just like just fuming, right? He's like, I got to get something to eat. And so they're like, okay, you know what? Well, they're like, we're going to Scarborough to a Walmart. And then we're like, well, we can drive out there and meet you guys and do it there. So we drive out. Sorry. That was my wife. Don't worry. It was.
You can answer.
No. Oh, one second. Hey, Laura, how's it going? Hey. No, can I call you back? Hey, I love you. Bet. Don't worry. Now we're back. And so Dolph Ziggler's like, yeah, we can leave that in. We don't have to take that out.
Okay.
Yeah, there's nothing to do.
I'll probably forget anyway.
I know. So that's normally how it works on the show when you're like, oh, I'm going to go back and take that out. And then I notice it's in the show. I noticed my flub last time, though, got edited out. When I nearly slandered someone.
Oh, that time. Well, you try to catch what you can.
Yeah, exactly.
You try and get it.
But anyway, so we go out. We're driving out to Scarborough, stuck in the worst traffic jam. We miss our interview time. We get there, but they're stuck in traffic behind us, so they miss the interview time. So by the time they get there, we're in the back of Walmart, where, like, you know, the bowels of Walmart, like where you're not supposed to shoot with a camera type thing. And they're like, if you shoot any of this stuff, we're throwing you out.
Oh, yeah, I've been there. Yeah.
And then they give us like this little tiny, like the shittiest green room ever they've set up for him. And he walks into the green room and we're there. And he's just like, ugh. And they're like, you have 5 minutes with Dolph Ziggler.
Is this at Scarborough Town Center?
Is that the one, like, this Walmart way in Scarborough, right?
I think so.
Yeah, it must have been that one.
I think that's the same Walmart where I interviewed Chris Jericho for the first time ever.
Oh, really?
2004. Yeah, it was terrible.
Well, I guess they haven't updated the decor.
Yeah, right in the middle of the interview, terrible. Like, big intercom system, someone comes over top of it. Oh, just the worst.
So they gave us 5 minutes with them, and I just went, and we had a whole show planned, so I'm like, okay, let's go. And so I'm just like, hey, everyone, welcome to The Wedge. I'm here with Dolph Ziggler. Dolph, how's it going? Hey, blah, blah, blah. And we got a whole episode in 5 minutes done.
Wow. The magic behind The Wedge.
It was awesome. Then my producer, Mike Van Kooten, shout out to Mike, turns to the WWE executive producer person, talent relations type person who's in with him, and turns to her and goes, and that's how you make TV. And then we finished.
That's awesome.
It was incredible. But yeah, he was pretty nice, you
That's
know.
Awesome.
I'm not going to pretend like
TV.
He'll remember me or is friends with me or anything like that, but by the end of it, and at one point I shilled for the WWE network. I'm like, "When are we going to get the WWE network in Canada?" And he's like, "Oh." And after off camera, he's like, "Vince McMahon would love you for saying that. And I'm like, well, make sure he sees that. And he's like, I will. I'm sure he didn't, but.
So they made you drive all the way out to Scarborough.
5 minutes.
Holy Christ.
Yo, I'll do that for wrestling, John.
I'd be
I'll
a little
do
annoyed
that
at that. Wow.
I was a little annoyed until I realized that I was getting paid to go hang out for 5 minutes with a wrestler.
Well, yeah.
That was like my
devil's advocate could say that as Dolph was he's also getting paid to do interviews and could have done a 5 minute interview saving you what, an hour to get out to Scarborough?
Oh no, believe me.
Rush hour?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Fuck Dolph
Ziggler.
Making
you zigzag through the DVP to get out to.
Well, you know what? Well, I hope they take his push away from him now. Oh wait. No, I'm just kidding. He was awesome. He was cool. It wasn't his fault. It was like, you know, I'm sure no one had showed up for this press day. He must have been sitting there for like 3 hours waiting for people to show up for this press day. Were you guys there?
I wasn't invited.
Yeah, if you weren't invited, you're the wrestling media in Toronto, right?
Like, they don't care about
us. The guy from Sun, the guy who writes at the Sun. Like, who else would else be there? Like, you know, for wrestling media. Like, I didn't see him on any of the morning shows or any of the talk shows. Like, these are all sit-down interviews. He must have been sitting there for 2 hours waiting for someone to show up.
Wow.
And then we showed up late. Here, I'm defending him again. Fuck Dolph Ziggler again. No,
you know, it almost sounds like a communist-run.
That's true. Good segue.
For pro wrestling.
Good segue. It does sound a little totalitarian.
Very much so. What is this? North Korea, circa 1995, April 28th,
29th. And it, you know what? For 1995, it felt so much older.
It really did, mainly because the quality of this video was atrocious. This felt like a fourth-generation dubbed VHS tape.
Well, and I guess we can get into it. Why don't we set it up, and I'll ask my first question to you, if you know. But yeah, like I just can't believe, like, you know, I was trying to place the year on this thing, and at one point they give a year of something happening in the past. I'm like, what? This is after that point? And I think the year was like 93. And I'm like, I can't believe this is not after 93. But it's just like, it's amazing to see how far ahead WWE's product was just production value-wise at this point, too.
Yeah, they had a lot of issues with the actual just feed of this. In fact, apparently what happened was when they got the masters from I guess New Japan or whoever was filming this, it came back with Japanese commentary on it, and they didn't have like a separate audio track. So basically had to lower the volume so that Bischoff, Tanay, and Kazuo Ishikawa, Sonny Ono, could do their commentary basically over top of it. And it also just looked like a really – like it just looked like a worn out tape. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't like – I understand this isn't HD in 1995, but man, this just – this wasn't even at WCW programming standards at the time.
But even the stuff they shot with the three of them I thought looked really bad.
Oh, with the green screen
behind it? With the green screen behind
them?
It and stuff? I was like, wow, Mike Tenay. Like, I thought – I'm like, it must be 1989, 90. I'm thinking, okay, it could be 90. And I'm like, no, but Eric Bischoff, when – like, I'm trying to do all the math in my head. But yeah, like, it just – I'm like, you know, I can understand, like – because I would imagine it was probably North Korean – cameras that must have shot it, because I couldn't imagine North Korean government letting Japanese cameras come in, maybe. Or
yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't know who would have handled the production of this. I mean, it was very much like New Japan WCW co-production, which this whole thing actually featured one actual contracted WCW performer.
Yeah, I was going to say, like,
Ric Flair was the only one technically under contract to WCW
at that
this
time.
Point, at that time,
really,
the Steiners were not with WCW at that time. Neither was Road Warrior Hawk. Neither was Benoit. Neither was Scorpio. I mean, it was essentially like WCW like gets like 50-50 credit for this, but it was like they provided Ric Flair, who was the backup because Hulk Hogan wasn't going to come over and lose to an Oki.
Yeah.
So Flair was their backup.
Wow, I had no idea. Well, that you know, because I'm watching that at the time, and I'm like, okay, they must have just gone through their roster of WCW guys and been like, okay, well, you worked in New Japan, you'll be someone that knows the style, can go over and do these matches. But none of them were. Wow, that's crazy.
Not officially. Benoit would start a few months later.
Yeah, I knew they
WCW.
They say that Benoit wasn't signed at the time, but I thought they said that Hawk had just returned, but maybe that was by the time the tapes had come back. They're like,
I think by that point he was, because 95. He had left WWF in 92, and then him and Animal had shown up in WCW, I want to say somewhere around 93 on one of those random Clash of the Champions shows. So they had kind of been in and out with the company. And then they came back It was either late 95 or early 96.
They
so
say,
this was a few months before that. And Hawk was doing all the stuff with Kensuke Sasaki over in New Japan.
Yeah, and they talk about later on in the commentary how this was going to actually supposed to, this was actually supposed to be the reunion. But then Animal had a back injury.
Yeah,
in.
And they were going to do a tag match with Tadeo Yasuda and Shinya Hashimoto. So
yeah.
You took out your IWGP champion. It was, well, it was what we got, Hawk and Tadeo Yasuda. But this, I imagine you had never seen this before. How did we even come up with this one?
Well,
I knew we were going to go the Japanese route because the G1's happening.
Yeah, because the G1 was happening. I was like, let's do a New Japan show. And you're like, okay, let's. And I was thinking, you know, we do something from the last couple, you know, last few years. But then you're like, would you want to do this show? And I'm like, absolutely. Because I'd heard about this pay-per-view. Because it is, I guess, the most watched.
I think I just typed in on YouTube. I'm like, what is easily accessible that both of us can easily watch? And this might have been the first thing that came up. Also knowing that I would be doing the G1 at this point, and this was only a two-hour show,
yeah.
That kind of twisted my arm as opposed to some four-hour New Japan marathon.
And also, I guess it's great that none of these names are people that you have to deal with during this tournament, right?
Nagata would be the only one.
Nagata's still there.
Yeah,
that's
Yuji
right.
Nagata, the youngster Yuji Nagata, who is now the anti-aging hero in New Japan at the age of 46.
Wow, that's crazy.
He wasn't even that much of a youngster.
No.
Like, they position him like he's, you know, fresh out of high school or something. I mean, he would have been 25 at this point already.
But that's Japan also, where you have a young boy system, I guess.
Absolutely.
Where you have, you do.
And graduate. He was still at that point, like him,
yeah.
And Kendo Kashin, Tokimitsu Ishikawa, just the black tights, black boots, which
yeah.
was the standard for it. It's like you don't get anything, any gimmicks, anything until you reach a certain level. So they were just coming up in that traditional system.
It's funny because in Japan, it's also kind of like that for music. Like in Burning Spirits hardcore, which is the type of Japanese hardcore that I love. I've talked about it on the show before, but that's like my thing. You know, you're a band for a long time before you get to the point where you're allowed to make a record. And it's almost like the older bands have to approve and say, okay, you can now make a record.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting system.
Yeah.
I always liked it in Japan. It was like you watch them come up through – and you essentially just watch them. And it would be like, you know, you're losing every single mm-hmm. night. And then you'd reach a point. You'd send the guy off to overseas. He'd come back. He learns a new maneuver, something like that. And it's essentially the story. Their whole career is a story. And it's divided into these chapters.
I think it also gives you – like a much stronger attachment as a fan if you've got
totally.
If you watch that person come up. Like,
there's a guy you watch right as he's starting as a young boy. If you were a yeah. Yuji Nagata fan in 1994 and you watched him come up in this point, and he went off
yeah.
to WCW in the late 90s, and then he would return. He'd have his runs with the IWGP title. And now you see him now. It's like, man, I've watched this guy from start to finish. I've seen where he's gone. And you pick your guys that when they start out, you might see something in. And you just become a fan of them. And you watch them go through this whole career progression.
Yeah, I kind of feel that like Michael Elgin. You know, you would have seen him at those shows too.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like working around here. And now he's like ROH champion. But
never
like,
would have thought he would
never,
reach this level.
Never. When people were like heckling him with Fat Hardy. I remember that like, everyone's yelling Fat Hardy at him because he looked kind of like Matt Hardy at the time, I guess. I wasn't yelling it. I would never yell at Michael if you're listening or you hear about this because I thought you were awesome even then. But
he's listening.
Yeah, he's listening. But anyway, like to watch him now at this point, it's like you definitely have like sort of like stronger attachments when you've rooted for someone since you saw them enter the biz or whatever. I didn't see him enter the business, but like watching him as a younger person in the world of wrestling, I guess.
This was a tour that a lot of the guys who came back from who had never – well, none of these guys had been to North Korea, but ones who were just kind of going into this not knowing what to expect. I mean, this sounded like it was just horror stories coming out of it of how much security there was. They had to be attached to the hip to tour guides. There were stories of some of the Americans having their hotels bugged. Just an unpleasant experience for a lot of these people. In North Korea and just experiencing this culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's like, you know, it's I've got some friends that have gone over there. One guy I know went over with that Dennis Rodman trip. And another guy
went over. Well, this was for Vice.
Well, the first time – I know one guy that went over to document it for the first Vice trip when they did went over to Dennis Rodman. But then, you know, Dennis Rodman went back on that second even sketchier trip. I know a guy that was on that trip. I don't know how he got on it, but he was on that second trip over there. And you know, both kind of say that, you know, it is what you'd expect now. But I think at this point, no one knew what to expect because this is kind of the first Western entrance back into North Korea since the Korean War, right? Or as far as I know. That's what they keep talking about on the show, at least.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I can only imagine how shocking that must have felt at that point.
Yeah, and essentially what this was this thing called the World Peace Festival, and Antonio Inoki was kind of able to broker this, where New Japan would provide a pro wrestling show working with World Championship Wrestling, so they would have distribution in the U.S. as well. They would get to bring in one WCW talent for this co-promoted show. And, yeah, you kind of saw some highlights of this, but it was a multi-day festival. There was other events going on and lots of kind of a very elaborate, like, ceremonies and stuff like that. And wrestling was a very integral part of this World Peace Festival and to this day is believed to be the most attended wrestling shows in history.
Have you watched that Vice Guide to North Korea, the first
documentary? No, I haven't seen it.
They still do these elaborate shows. There's one point where there's all these thousands of people performing the same sort of shows that we see on this wrestling pay-per-view. And it's just to Shane, the owner of Vice.
Yeah.
He's the only person watching. But they apparently still do these performances, just they don't have anyone to
do. Have you ever met Shane Smith?
I've met Shane a couple times just in passing. I more like know some of the other guys there, but like, yeah, I've only briefly. I don't know Shane as well as some of the other guys.
It's amazing there. The places this guy goes to.
Yeah. Yeah, him, Andy Capper is a doc. He's like he's a good friend of ours. He's done, you know, some of the places they've gone. It's just crazy. Well, I guess that's the reason Vice has become such a news outlet.
Yeah,
you know, whoever thought that we'd be saying that? But like, they go to places that a lot of other people don't go, and they have people on the ground in a lot of places that people don't necessarily have people on the ground. So
maybe he would have gone to this in '95.
I don't know. I've never talked to any of those dudes really about wrestling. You know, that's like the one ground.
Might
I
be a subject they haven't really tackled on Vice.
Well, they Fightland. They've done some stuff about wrestling.
That's true. Yeah,
you know. And I did do an interview with Jim Ross. That's going to show up on Vice one day.
One day.
One day. I have no idea when or where. Because
this was at a barbecue joint in Toronto.
We went for barbecue with me and JR. And
got his approval.
It got his approval. It won him over. I gotta say. He did not take this restaurant seriously at all. I would put it so far as to say he was probably thinking bowling shoe in his head when he walked in there. But by the end, oh my gosh, he was blown away. So much so that he said, and I quote, "The chicken skin on this fried chicken is good enough to get Jim Cornette to come back to Canada."
Wow. That's an endorsement.
Yeah, absolutely.
That should be a quote on their wall.
I know. I think so, except they probably – I don't know.
What's this place called again in Toronto?
It's called Electric Mud.
Electric Mud.
And I will strongly recommend anyone go there if you're a fan of, you know, barbecue food, fried chicken. It's really good.
Give them some love.
And bourbon, too.
And bourbon. For lunch.
Yeah, JR was they were like, you know, trying to get him a drink and they didn't have anything he wanted. And then eventually the guy's like, "This is a bourbon bar, but I'll bring you something you're going to like." And at this point, JR's just like, you know, I don't think he took that seriously. Very early into the meal. So the guy brings out the bourbon and explains what it is to JR. And JR's eyes go like saucers. And
it was probably
really
the best meal
it.
He had here in Canada.
He really enjoyed it.
I can say the places I went with him, he was not ecstatic about. Let's just leave it at that.
No, I think it's fairly safe to say this might have been his most enjoyed meal in Canada. But I'm going to also say, in your defense or whoever picked the other restaurants' defense, it's a tough critic. You know,
he is.
He has been around the world and eaten at a lot of different types of places. So.
I believe the one place, the first night we went for dinner, and after having the dinner, all the food come, his assessment was, well, the beer was cold. That was good.
Yeah, so I think I did right by him. You know, like that.
I gave him a quality meal here in Toronto. You did the city proud.
I did the city proud, and I. So that will be appearing on Vice one day. So Vice does do some sort of wrestling stuff. They also at one point were like, you know, to me like, "Do you want to go to WrestleMania and cover it for us?" And that never really happened. So, you know, I'm hoping that's
what was your response? I'll have to check.
Yeah, I'm like, absolutely. They're like, "Would you like to meet?" You know, and they gave me like a bunch of wrestlers to do interviews with them.
Nope.
I'm like, "Guys, you're talking to the wrong dude here. Not really a fan." But it didn't happen. But yeah, so, you know, now that Much Music when the Wedge is gone, maybe that's a place I can shoehorn wrestling interviews.
Hey, you could do a lot worse.
Well, they actually did a great little documentary about Smash Wrestling recently.
Oh, really? Yeah. I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, they did a little piece on them, and they've done The British Wrestler.
I've seen that.
Grado and stuff. So there are wrestling fans there. I think that's the thing about wrestling fans. Wrestling fans show up everywhere. You know, it's like
there were some insane championship wrestling fans that were none too happy about our review. I thought we were very fair.
Yeah, I think so. I thought you.
They have a rabid audience, and I can guarantee you that most of them listened to that review, and most of them, I think, were not happy that we didn't give it more love. But
really,
hey, I didn't think the documentary was fantastic. I mean, what do you want me to do?
Yeah, like that's and also
not an indictment on your promotion, but the documentary was what it was. It was average.
I'd heard so much about that documentary going into that documentary, and I'd also heard a lot about that federation, obviously, from people over there when we tour over there. So I'm really excited to see what it's like live and stuff like that. But just like your assessment of the documentary was not at all what I expected the documentary to be. And that's about the documentary, once again, not about the – you know, like with a documentary, if you have a poorly done documentary with an amazing subject, it might not make your subject look very good in the end, unfortunately. And, you know, out of the BBC, you'd expect something different, but –
it's subjective.
That British one is – I thought the an English wrestler – was it a British wrestler?
Yeah.
Is that what's called? Yeah, I thought that was a fantastic documentary and stuff like that. And I look forward to maybe going over and see them one day.
One day. Introduce the Mangina to Grado. You and Grado.
That show that they're running in Glasgow, I've played that venue before. Like for their big
the Hydro?
No. What's the big one they're building up to?
Oh, God damn it. I can't remember.
I opened for a band there.
Oh, really?
And it was it's a big hall, a huge hall.
Wow.
So it would be really neat to see, you know. I still haven't watched that documentary. I should. That's going to be on my to-do list now.
Well, on our to-do list right now is WCW New Japan Collision in Korea. This was taped April 28th and 29th. So it was two nights of shows, and then they just put random matches together for this particular pay-per-view, which didn't air until August the 5th later that year. This was like one of the TNA one-night-only pay-per-views.
How did this do as buys go, I wonder?
I don't know the answer. My guess would be poor.
Poor, yeah.
I would think.
Especially at that time period.
I don't know how much of a draw Antonio Inoki, Ric Flair on tape delay would be. Maybe to some. I mean,
I love that match. We'll talk about that, I guess.
Yeah, we'll get into that. It's hosted, as we mentioned, by Eric Bischoff, Mike Tenay, and the future Sonny Ono under the name, his real name, Kazuo Ishikawa, who, of course, longtime friends with Eric Bischoff. The two had come up together and both very much into kickboxing, and that would reflect in some of their analysis of different combat sports. Generally said, I thought the announcing was horrendous on this show.
Now, what do you think is going through the minds of the North Koreans here?
A couple of crazy Americans and a Russian.
A couple of very gifted, very talented, very powerful crazy Americans inside of the wrestling ring, I think would be a little bit more accurate. Not to put words in your mouth, but that's exactly what you were trying to say, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you.
I thought for the most part, absolutely, completely horrendous. I did think at times they were still doing a better job than that heel run of Michael Cole a couple years ago.
Well, that's high praise.
That's like my lowest benchmark of like.
I really wish Tenay could have gone solo.
I wish.
Here.
And there like, was a moment in the first match where Bischoff's like, "Okay, we're going to hear. There's a lot of time for you to talk about your Japanese wrestling stuff later."
Yeah, it was just like Bischoff was really bad on this show.
Yeah. So was Sonny Ono.
He was unnecessary. Like Sonny Ono and Bischoff were unnecessary on the show, but man, Sonny Ono added nothing. It was like his role was to play subtle Japanese heel, and it was terrible. It didn't work. Just really poor.
Yeah.
And especially coming off, it was the year prior where Mike Tenay and Chris Cruz did the When Worlds Collide pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. And same concept where you're projecting to an American audience that is probably unfamiliar with a lot of this talent and the style of pro wrestling, but Mike Tenay is brilliant in. He follows all of this stuff, so pair him with a competent color man, he does color to Chris Cruz's play-by-play. Boom. We've got a perfect team here already.
And I guess it was edited together, like you said, the show, so they didn't have any say in it, but like, it never shows the scope, except at the very beginning, of how big these wrestling matches were.
Yeah, that was another big – like, you would never have any idea that there were 100,000 plus people. Like, no aerial shots, nothing to really emphasize how many people are here, and your guy, Ric Flair, is in the main event.
Yeah.
Like, give me a helicopter shot.
Yeah.
Come on.
Or even, like, or even just panning into the audience of, like, especially in that final match. I guess maybe it was dark and you couldn't get those shots, but just, like, the audience was reacting to some of the...
Like, they were legit, over the course of these 2 days, 300,000 plus people.
And you never know it.
And that will never happen again in pro wrestling.
Well, it might, because I hear they're trying to run another one of these in North
Korea. They're talking about running another one of these this summer in North Korea. And maybe they can approach that figure again.
They can force that many people to go out again, I'm sure.
We'll
apparently,
see.
All these people were forced to go.
Not all. There were tickets sold. And,
yeah.
And a lot of them. And it's a weird area where some of them, like, the ticket prices, like, range from all these different prices. And allegedly, tickets were all purchased for. But, yeah, like, the poorer sections were all kind of mandated that you were to attend this Peace Festival.
Yeah. And sit up way up in the top.
Like, but it wasn't like 300,000 people just walked in and no one paid. Like, there was a gate for this thing. Impressive nonetheless. But so weird that it's... It's not like it was indicative of any kind of popularity or like this was a place you could go back and tour. It was just kind of this one-off thing where the novelty was this thing called pro wrestling that most people had never seen live in their life.
And I don't know if it was like, you know, part of the storyline that they were trying to get across, but like they kept talking about how Inoki is a legit star in North Korea. And there were stamps and silver coins with his image on it.
Oh, yeah. Like, he's the one trying to broker this deal for another show in North Korea and is... gone so much that he's gone against the Japanese government, who doesn't want him traveling to North Korea, and he has traveled there. And for whatever reason, he does have that kind of stardom in North Korea.
But they said even before the show.
Yeah.
They were talking about it, like, because of Ricky Doza?
Ricky Dozan.
Yeah, is he? But he's from North
Ricky Korea? Ricky Dozan was born in Korea, but was always portrayed as being Japanese, and it was only years later after his death that it was revealed that he was actually Korean.
Korean. And but I guess because he trained... Inoki, they were talking about how that was the connection.
He was like, loose, like, protege of Inoki. I mean, it was very much seen like Ricky Dozan came, and then it was kind of his proteges were Giant Baba and Antonio Inoki, who splintered off, and thus was the creation of All Japan, New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Who's Steve Aoki's father?
Steve Aoki?
Yeah,
I don't
know the DJ?
Yeah, I know the DJ.
His dad was an Olympic wrestler who owned Benihana restaurants. And... his dad was like and I think his dad actually did pro wrestling too, but he was like a really famous Japanese Olympic wrestler, apparently.
Hmm.
Like won the gold medal in the 1940-something Olympics.
Steve Aoki, who some people have said has a shocking resemblance to the regular co-host of this show, but I will not make that comparison.
I would say that they just have similar facial hair.
They do. And this T-shirt that he's wearing right now, very similar to something Wei Ting would wear.
I saw Steve Aoki also has a Gorilla Biscuits back piece that what some would call a tramp stamp.
Oh, boy. That's a tough look to overcome.
It's a tough look, but it's a Gorilla Biscuits tattoo, which is kind of cool.
I'm not sure who his father is.
Really? It didn't say?
It didn't say in here.
I'm looking. Yeah, it was his parents. No?
His father was was a former Japanese wrestler who also founded the restaurant chain Benihana.
Yeah.
He has two siblings. Okay.
But doesn't say who his dad is?
Graduated star player. He's the third child of Rocky Aoki and Shizuru Kobayashi.
Yeah, Rocky Aoki.
Name is not Hiroaki Aoki. I'm not familiar with the name.
Maybe
Japanese pro wrestler. Unbelievable, Damien. He moved to New York City to win the United States flyweight title. He was inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in 1995.
Yeah, he was actually, like, apparently a wrestler of some note.
He was expelled for fighting after attending KO University, where he competed in track and field, karate, and wrestling. Qualified for the 1960 Summer Olympics at Rome, did not compete. However, he later toured the U.S. and was undefeated in the wrestling 112-pound flyweight class. So he did amateur wrestling. Doesn't say too much here about his pro wrestling time. Well, there you go.
I wonder at that point, that's the other thing. Is there anywhere to get, other than Wikipedia and various articles, a concise sort of history maybe not even concise, a history of Japanese pro wrestling?
Oh, yeah. At WH Park 9 on Twitter.
Okay.
I mean, there's some really good books out there that you can check out. If you read Total MMA is a book that Jonathan Snowden wrote, and it kind of traces kind of the lineage and explains kind of the whole Japanese wrestling scene at the time. That's a really good starter to check that out. You know, Dave Meltzer's tribute books, it has like a lot of bios on, you know, deceased wrestlers like your Giant Babas.
Give you the histories.
And that kind of, essentially tell the Ricky Dozan as well. You can read about those. That's kind of some of the best places to check out. But in terms of like the concise kind of history of Japanese wrestling, it hasn't really.
It just kind of seems like, you know, the rise of New Japan's women in at this period, or like the All Japan women's at different periods, and like just kind of the ascents of different divisions in wrestling, and kind of, I don't know, just a fascinating kind of area to look at.
Yeah, and we'll get into that with the women on this show from All Japan women, who were, I mean, you could watch it this time where they were, I mean, it was the best match on the show,
insane.
In my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know, I really enjoyed, we'll go into it, but the second match,
Well, we started off with Too Cold Scorpio and Wild Pegasus, Chris Benoit. And Too Cold Scorpio comes into the ring, just zero reaction to his breakdancing in the ring. This Korean audience is sitting without any reaction to this man.
Well, this is probably their first exposure to breakdancing.
Probably.
In a lot of cases, right? So
Bischoff reminds us that this is a communist country and how Scorpio represents something different.
Well, that's probably true, too, for a lot of people in, you know, the stadium who might not have been exposed to, you know, and I guess I'm assuming Bischoff is implying because he's African-American.
I don't know what he was insinuating, but Benoit refuses to shake his hand, and Tanay brings up the fact that Benoit had just won the very first Super J Cup the prior year.
He had the trophy.
Yes. They go back and forth. Crowd actually did react to some of it early on. There was a monkey flip by both, the Greco-Roman knuckle lock. They go back and forth. Benoit just, at one point, the crowd's kind of just sitting there, and he, like, is clapping and trying to rally the crowd. And then there's a super kick by Scorpio, and this is where we get that Sonny Ono is going to play the subtle heel. And essentially his gimmick is, well, Japanese wrestlers, they're the real wrestlers, not like these American slobs that cheat and come over here and aren't real wrestlers. And Benoit reverses, hits a tombstone pile driver, diving headbutt, and pins Scorpio 6 minutes, 2 seconds. Very quick match. Not much you could really get into here. But
it's weird because, like, obviously Benoit being Benoit, going on to become a legendary wrestler, and in Too Cold Scorpio becoming like an unbelievable wrestler. But this felt like an indie match. Like everything about it, including Benoit trying to get the claps going with the audience and
stuff.
Right, there were some cool spots, like when he threw him on the ropes. Yeah, when Benoit picked Too Cold Scorpio and threw him onto the ropes, which I imagine probably didn't feel good because those ropes probably were not designed to have that kind of weight dropped on them or anything like that. But, apart from that, it was like a really unspectacular kind of opening match.
Just like, you know, your six-minute opener. A lot of these matches, they didn't let them go too long for fear that the crowd would just get restless. Yuji Nagata, a young Yuji Nagata, taking on Tokumitsu Ishizawa, who would later become Kendo Kashin. For fans of both New Japan and All Japan. Both here, they say, are 26 years old and three-year veterans. And as I mentioned, both in black tights, black boots, just your standard, like, young boys that are now graduating to that next level, but given kind of the bare minimum when it comes to just appearance. Ono says how this is how pro wrestling was meant to be, with two great Japanese wrestlers, and notes that their technique is superior and knocks the lack of sportsmanship from Americans. And Nagata tries for a Kimura, and Ishizawa then starts working for an armbar off his back, and Bischoff tries to break this down here, saying that as Ishizawa is going for an armbar off of his back, that this is a, quote, defensive position. Now, I understand that fighting has evolved quite a lot over the past two decades, but I mean, this was 1995. Jiu-jitsu was becoming pretty important with the UFC launching a year and a half before this event happened. And Bischoff seemed to have absolutely no idea about anything here outside of kickboxing when it came to these kind of what arts can be used here.
Well, it's also funny because like that first UFC pay-per-view feels very dated, but still feels way more modern than this pay-per-view.
Yeah, it really did. And it just felt like there was this – it was this brand new way of how fighting was being presented, yeah. and jiu-jitsu was a huge part of that. And you listen, and it was just completely – they had no real connection to it at all here, especially Ishikawa and Bischoff.
Well, he also – he miscalls moves all the time, and like he just – when did he leave commentary?
I guess Bischoff?
Yeah.
Up until he turned, which was like 97. 96? 96. 96 he stayed until.
Yeah, he's not good. Like every time people call him a third-rate commentator and all that kind of stuff, it's like that's –
he self-admittedly will tell you he was not a great commentator.
Yeah, no, not at
least self-awareness. Anyway, Nagata continues, tries for a rear naked choke. Sorry, Ishizawa tries for a rear naked choke. He starts stomping Nagata, uppercuts in the corner, into an armbar. Nagata makes it to the rope. Nagata then hits an overhead suplex, kicks him in the chest, and then locks on the Nagata lock, which was not a defensive position, and gets the instant submission at 4 minutes and 28 seconds, and then both shake hands after the match, and Yuji Nagata would go on to have a hell of a career.
I thought they just hit so hard. Everything in this match looks so... And obviously, like, you know, Scorpio and Benoit were working in Japan too, but just like a lot of the moves they were doing look like more wrestling moves, whereas these look like more like fighting moves. Like it felt like the style of wrestling was a lot closer to what Benoit would do later on. Like a lot.
Yeah, well, you had the grappling kind of backgrounds of these two, and it worked really well. But very quick match, so I mean, not something that was given too much time, but good for what it was. Bischoff notes how the North Korean government spent a year planning this event. They show a ceremony with a bunch of the dancers. And then it was a tag match with Hiro Saito and Masahiro Chono against Tadeo Yasuda, who we would get a double dose of on this particular show, and El Samurai. And Saito and Chono, they come out to this stock music that would eventually become Rey Mysterio's theme in WCW.
Oh, really? Yeah. Same music.
They had they love that track 84-6.
on the library of hard rock sounds.
Oh, yeah. That's Hiro Saito, Masa Chono. Let's bring him out to Rey's future theme. They note Yasuda's transition from sumo wrestling and comparing it to when NFL players would transition to pro wrestling back in North America. Saito and Chono, they isolate the arm of Yasuda. They work it over. Yasuda hits a big boot to Chono, misses an elbow drop. Saito then comes in, delivers a spine buster to Samurai. And Mike Tenay, you know, when he could get in some stories, he could weave them in well. He explained kind of Lou Thesz trained Chono and would explain a lot of the backstories of these guys that most of the audience probably at most had only heard their names and didn't really know too much about. But it was very difficult in a three-man booth where Mike Tenay really wasn't able to add too much more than what was on this.
Well, especially because Bischoff almost had like veto over anyone. He'd just be like, stop talking or like unplug their mic for a minute type thing.
Chono hits the mafia kick to Samurai, then a shoulder block off the top as Saito knocks Yasuda off the apron, and then Chono pins Samurai 8 minutes, 6 seconds.
I thought I think Samurai's mask is the coolest.
Yeah, it's got a cool mask.
It looks like something out of like an anime, and with the long hair in the back too. But the singlet just does nothing for that mask. It's just like – it's like a Barry Horowitz singlet.
Yeah, a little bit.
With a future mask on top.
Hey, man. You can age, though, in those masks. So
you can, that's
matter.
True.
It's got to cover up the body a bit more as the age progresses.
Yeah, you need a full bodysuit. You need like
– that's how you work smart, man. It's like if I were becoming a wrestler and someone wants advice, be like, wear a mask.
Wear a mask.
Wear a mask and you can work – forever.
Wear a mask and wear a shirt and pants.
Now, Jushin Liger, smartest worker ever.
Yep, it's true. Well, still like, you know, I don't know. He worked a pretty high-flying style.
He did, but then he toned it down, and
yeah,
it's like you
true.
Can never tell that guy's age
that's
from
true,
looking
yeah,
at him.
That's true. Nothing. And he still is the guy that everyone, like, freaks out for at when he comes to, like, Toronto.
Oh, it's the costume, the mask, just the fact that everyone knows that name if you're a, you know, semi-diehard wrestling fan.
Yeah, I will say, though, when Chris Charlton took me to see New Japan, we're, like, watching. We're like, oh, look, there's Liger. He's just like – I'm like, why is Liger sitting by the heel entrance? He's just sitting there in a tracksuit with his mask on and the full suit underneath the tracksuit. He's just, like, sitting there, and he's like, I don't know, maybe they're going to work an angle or something. And then sure enough, no, it's just a fan dressed exactly like him. So it's an easy gimmick to kind of steal
right.
as just someone else being an imposter of you.
How about the track suits on this show for the Japanese wrestlers with
those
their
are
names
awesome.
On the back?
But were they like the North Korean colors, right? Like the red,
yeah.
white, and blue?
So, I guess maybe it was specific for the Peace Festival. The Peace Festival tracksuits.
That's going to be after the Ribera steak jacket with matching Zubaz as my number two most wanted.
Damien's
going to
be on eBay later tonight looking for Yuji Nagata's tracksuit from 1995.
I don't think there's any of those tracksuits would fit me, unfortunately. I'm going to have to find the what's his name, the sumo guy's.
Tadeo Yasuda?
Yeah, see if they made one for him.
They show a montage of Ric Flair, Muhammad Ali, who would be ringside for the main event, of course, playing off of the famous 1976 match involving Muhammad Ali and Antonio Inoki. One of the worst matches you will ever see.
Well, except for that, have you seen that Inoki match versus the great Mizaki?
No.
It's like a Japanese match. Colt Cabana talked about it one time on his podcast, and so I looked at it afterwards. It's the funniest, most brutal wrestling match of all time, where it's like some guy from Memphis who's just no-selling all of Inoki's moves, and then Inoki just like kicks his knees out from under him and just beats the shit out of him for real, and then pins him, and the match is over like 5 minutes later. And you just see this guy get up like, what the hell happened to me?
Oh, that's the best Antonio Inoki style of match.
Oh, it's incredible. This match is just so
short,
awesome.
Burst of energy and keep the people happy.
I guess then, lying on your back like a turtle kicking is not as cool.
No, not as much, especially when it's 15 rounds. up next, my highlight of the show, Mariko Yoshida and Manami Toyota against Bull Nakano and Akira Hokuto. Bischoff notes how Toyota is a very attractive young woman. And there was this obvious voiceover change, like the audio. There was some disaster with it. It sounded like they were calling this over the phone line or something.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Like, were any of these guys – Bischoff keeps referring to the fact that he was –
Bischoff
there.
Went on the trip, but they did all the commentary back home in a production studio Ono and Tanay, who did not go to North Korea. It was just Bischoff and Flair.
Maybe this was just the transfer. That was that bad because the audio quality kept changing.
It
like,
was terrible during this beginning part. But man, what a match this was.
Yeah.
Toyota goes off the top with a crossbody, gets caught by Nakano and Hokuto. Nakano then kills Toyota with a clothesline, comes back, hits a missile dropkick with a scoop slam then by Nakano, splash by Hokuto. Hokuto comes back with a pile driver to Yoshida, attacks the left knee, applies a surfboard. Nakano comes in with a scorpion cross that you would now familiarize yourself as a page's finish. Yoshida does a cartwheel and then a cross body block, handspring back elbow. I mean, just the offense here. And, I mean, Bischoff was just lost here. He didn't know what he was calling here. And Tanay had to, like, interject himself to explain a springboard cross body to the floor. Toyota comes off the top into the feet of Hokuto, who then stacks Nakano, then stacks Toyota with a power bomb for a two count. They double team Hokuto, send her to the floor. There's a suicide dive by Yoshida, springboard plancha by Toyota off the top to the floor, and the finish comes as Hokuto scoop slams Yoshida, and Nakano finishes with a top rope leg drop and pins her. All of this in 8.5 minutes. It was just frenetic pace. I thought this was excellent.
Yeah, it's like I love Japanese women's wrestling. I think most people probably do, especially this period, I guess. But like, this was awesome. Yeah, like everything felt like it meant something. People's selling was great. Just like the heels felt so evil and so much bigger, and the baby faces felt like so much like baby faces. And even when you watch like FMW women's wrestling, it's kind of the same sort of way. Like I guess it's sort of like the same sort of heel face dynamic is kind of what they use across Japanese women's wrestling.
Yeah, and I mean the standard was just so high for the women, you know, coming off of, you know, all of the women that had preceded them. And if you watch that Gaia Girls documentary, you see kind of their dojo system mm-hmm. of where match quality is, you know, it's extremely high. And these women at this point in time were as talented as the men anywhere in the world at this point. I mean, All Japan Women from 93 to 95, 96. I mean, that was a dynamite promotion.
I would love to see – that's like what I'd love to see is like a documentary about that period and see what like the lifestyle was like behind the scenes for these women. You know, because they are really popular and legitimately drawing parts of the card, whereas now, you know, the argument could be made in WWE that like it's an accessory to – the other wrestling, but at this time it's like as much a part of the real wrestling, like male wrestling, quote unquote, real wrestling, whatever.
Like I thought this stole the show. I thought this was just incredible.
I wonder what it was like backstage for these women at this point. Like, was it like a wild rock star kind of like existence, or was it just like being beaten up? Like, would you go to the sponsor dinners afterwards? Because in Japan, they always have those big sponsor dinners after wrestling events where you're supposed to go and hang out and drink with the sponsors all night.
Well, after a match like this, this was only 8 minutes. I mean, there were others where, fuck, they'd go like 35.
Yeah.
You know? Ooh. So very solid match here from the women on this show, followed by Scott Norton and Shinya Hashimoto, which was actually the main event of the first night.
Yeah, you can tell because the ring announcer from New Japan changes from a purple outfit to a white outfit after this match.
Yes. So they at least did explain the fact that this were two nights of matches spliced together. Shinya Hashimoto came out. He was the IWGP champion at the time this was taped, but like 2 days later lost this title to the Great Muda, so was not the champion when this did air. But this kind of, it does explain the finish, why it was done, and not wanting to beat Hashimoto, or Norton for that matter, they didn't want to beat. Norton was sporting this fantastic Danny Davis-inspired singlet. The black and white
stripes.
Bischoff
very ahead of his time. It's like Robin Thicke.
Yeah, exactly like Robin Thicke. When I see Scott Norton, that's immediately what I think of.
I think that could save Robin Thicke's career if he started just getting on the gas and getting huge.
Eric Bischoff explains that.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, it's different when you talk about conditioning. You know, you look at Scott Norton, and here's a guy who obviously spends a tremendous amount of time in a gym. You look at Hashimoto, you think, here's a guy who spends a lot of time in a Japanese version of a Pizza Hut.
Some people watching Shinya Hashimoto might just assume that he spends his time in the Japanese version of Pizza Hut. But no, he's really tough. Like, this guy sounded like just completely oblivious to what he was watching.
Yeah.
Or what, just unreal that this guy was calling this.
Not a tape trader.
No, it was not too familiar with Hashimoto. So anyway, Ono quietly notes early into the match, he just quietly says into the mic that Scott Norton has a lot of balls. I guess for taking this challenge of Shinya Hashimoto, a lot of balls. Hashimoto hits a spinning heel kick and works over the left arm of Norton. A drop kick sends Norton down, grabs the right arm, but then Norton pulls him down to the mat. Ono just takes a shot at the cheap tactics here of this American, Scott Norton, who can't compete with a world-class athlete like Shinya Hashimoto. Norton hits a Vader bomb, gets a two count. Norton applies a rear chin lock. Bischoff is asked how Hashimoto, he wonders, you know, if this guy came over to America, how would he fare against the likes of Big Bubba or Vader? And there was this real shitty-looking DDT by Scott Norton. Bischoff explains that this is one of the first times North Korea has opened the country up to the foreign press, noting that, you know, Reuters was covering this, CNN was covering this. There was a vertical suplex. Hashimoto gets his foot on the rope, and we're getting down as the time limit expires. Norton hits a power bomb, hits a top rope splash for a two count, and the 20 minutes expires, so we do not get a finish. Not a great match. I think it was they were going at a very slow pace. You kind of got the idea, especially when they mentioned the time limit being 20 minutes, that this one was probably going the distance, and they were not going to beat either guy. So not the greatest way to end a show on night number one.
No, but I think the best thing about that match was hearing about all the trouble Scott Norton had in North Korea and imagining Scott Norton in North Korea.
And Bischoff relaying his stories of going to high school with Scott Norton.
Yeah.
It was clear Bischoff knew nothing about Hashimoto and everything about Scott Norton.
Yep.
And it was just, you know, well, I got 20 minutes. I got 20 minutes worth of stories here about Scott Norton. Bad commentary.
Bad commentary. Terrible commentary. But, like, yeah, I guess, like, that being said, no one would really have – well, I don't know. They did talk about in the commentary how wrestling had been on 24/7 on Japanese TV for the past couple weeks. Korean TV for the last couple weeks. They've been showing Ric Flair matches and stuff. So, you know, maybe people were familiar. But I was going to say, like, you know, for the most part, people in the audience would have no idea what to expect. So they might think this is the greatest wrestling match of all time.
And perhaps they did. I think just the sheer size of these two
is
really an impressive – sight to see live.
I'm surprised, though, you didn't have more of – I guess you do in the main event the next day, but more of a American guy losing.
Oh,
I guess
right.
I guess Japan is also equally an enemy to Korea or North Korea, I should say, at that point. But I just felt like, oh, it'd just be such an easy kind of like play to the crowd.
Yeah, it was actually pretty much the opposite
in
most of the booking, except for the main event with the Americans. We had Tadeo Yasuda and Road Warrior Hawk. This one did not go the time limit. They explained this was on a separate night, so this is why you're seeing Yasuda twice. They run at each other, with Yasuda doing the traditional sumo stance, knocks down Hawk. Then Hawk comes off the rope with a jumping shoulder block and takes him down. Hawk misses with a splash off the top. Yasuda hits a double underhook suplex. Hawk no-sells it, standing right back up, and clotheslines him, power slam, and a top rope clothesline to pin Yasuda at 2 minutes and 21 seconds.
And just kills him.
And that was it.
But did that clothesline look like a legit clothesline off the top?
Oh, he probably
looks like he's
adjusted his vertebrae.
Yeah, pulling him down with his arm.
The Steiner brothers against Kensuke Sasaki and Hiroshi Hase. These two teams actually had the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Match of the Year in 1991. Didn't reprise that same style of match this time. They also had a lot less time. And what was most noticeable about this was before the Steiner brothers returned to WCW. So Bischoff took this time during this match to basically say how they had a lot of potential, but a lot of it's been squandered, and it's questionable if they could hang with the big boys in WCW. Like, taking all these shots at the Steiners in this match, it seemed so unnecessary.
He was saying it was like an audition for them to see.
Yeah, like these guys were making a hell of a lot of money right now in Japan. They were doing just fine. It was just very strange, and it wasn't like the average viewer at home would be aware of the WCW Steiner brothers politics at the time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Anyway, Bischoff says how they he goes over all of this. And then Bischoff just drifts off to talk about Kensuke Sasaki's parents' restaurant that they have in town and calls it culinary ecstasy that he enjoyed going to their restaurant. Then Mike Tenay brings up the fact about how Kensuke Sasaki and Akira Hokuto, they met each other recently and are now engaged.
You talk about marriage and an interesting story about Kensuke Sasaki as we see him climb the top rope and comes off and, is caught by Rick Steiner, who bellies him right over the top. Kensuke Sasaki at this event in North Korea was introduced to Akira Hokuto, who we saw earlier on the card, power slam by Sasaki.
Yeah, I heard about that the next morning, by the way.
And believe it or not, the two will be married later this year.
No, you're kidding me. And who'd have thunk it? I was there to see it. How about that? Well, you're a veritable wealth of information, Mike, today. I mean, you're like the WCW's version of the host of The Love Connection. This is great.
And Bischoff is finding this news out for the first time.
Yeah, except he seems to know that they had sex that night, because he keeps being like, I was there. Oh, wow,
Maybe it was a great first date for them.
Yeah.
Scott press slams Hase, sends him over the top to the floor onto one of the young boys, and Bischoff then brings up Jeff Blatnick winning the super heavyweight gold medal at the 1984 Games, just bringing up all his sports references here into this particular match. Bischoff at one point, he was just blown away by Mike Tenay's wrestling knowledge coming off of this Kensuke Sasaki, Akira Hokuto marriage story.
Yeah.
He was just so impressed. Mike Tenay, this encyclopedia. Rick hits this fully rotating suplex with Hase landing on his chest. Scott applies an STF to Hase. Ono just completely no-sells it. Says Hase will easily get out of this hold. It is nothing to worry about.
Yeah, and then you have to watch him get out of the hold for like another 30 seconds, a minute.
Great selling of urgency here.
And then there's like dead silence as you see him like get out of the hold.
The Steiners continue to work on Hase in their corner, eventually tags in Sasaki. Hase hits a choke slam. After Hase hits a choke slam, Hase comes in and hits the giant swing to Rick Steiner. And then Scott comes in, hits Hase with a pump handle slam. Sasaki breaks it up. Then Rick tackles Sasuke to the floor. And Scott Steiner lifts up Hase for the Steiner screwdriver. At least that's what I believe he hit him with, because the camera cut away and completely missed the move as Scott pins Hase for the win at 11:50.
Yeah, the camera angles were so weird on this show, like missing stuff, getting the wrong angles for stuff. So it must be It must have been.
It's almost like the maneuver was too violent and they didn't want to show it.
Away.
Like it felt like it was being purposely cut away from. So strange.
Yeah.
And the announcers had to call attention to the fact that, well, we didn't get to see that, but Steiner gets the pinfall.
I think it's in this match. I was trying to check where I wrote it down, but there's a shot where they shoot the announcers, like the Japanese announcers, the three-man booth from New Japan, I assume, on the side of the ring. And the announcers don't acknowledge it at all. So you see the mouths of these people on screen moving as these announcers are talking. And it looks like they're dubbed over. Which would be awesome if there's like – these people are just actually the New Japan commentators. And this is what the New Japan commentators were saying.
So the Steiners get the win. Then we go back to the announcers on camera to set up the main event. Sonny Ono says that Ric Flair does not stand a chance in this match.
Yeah.
Accurate, I guess. They show Flair and Inoki getting ready in the back, and then Muhammad Ali comes out. He's at ringside.
Was it deliberate that Flair was shot with like someone's shoulder handy cam and Inoki was shot by a professional film crew?
Oh, perhaps.
Did you notice that? Like Ric Flair's all jumpy and bumpy. He has
a definite
to go to, like,
bias
a
here when it comes to the technology.
And then Inoki's like in this huge thing. It was a crane shot, basically.
So Ali is out, as well as many of the Japanese wrestlers out in their tracksuits, Shinya Hashimoto, Hase, Nagata, Takeshi Iizuka, a lot of guys out here. Tanay points out this is Ric Flair's first match since his retirement from Halloween Havoc 94, where he lost to Hulk Hogan and would return in drag at the Uncensored pay-per-view, I believe.
Wow. This is
Super Brawl, maybe? It was the Super Brawl show where Ric Flair showed up in drag.
I remember I don't think I saw that show, but I remember the montage of him in drag.
Oh, yeah. It's fantastic stuff. Super Brawl 5.
Well,
Ric Flair, your legend, as he he is the one sent over here for this massive show, and there he is over in drag for his big return coming out of retirement a few months earlier.
And when did he cut his hair? Before, like, during the retirement?
Oh, it was before that. It was a couple of years before.
Because they had all the,
I want to say like 94-ish, he cut that hair.
All the photos they were using of him were of him with the long hair. And then all the shots of him.
Maybe it was sooner then.
At the short hair.
I tend to remember it was like, at least by the time they did that first Hogan match at the Bash at the Beach in 94, he had the shorter hair.
Mm-hmm.
But Tanay points out the fact that this is also the first match, first time these two had ever been in the ring together, Flair and Inoki. Inoki goes for a Kimura, which Bischoff notes is a defensive posture. I want Brock Lesnar to apply a Kimura to Bischoff as he identifies it as a defensive posture.
I think if they had booked that on TNA, we wouldn't have any news today.
Perhaps so. Inoki is stomping him in the corner. Flair bails to the floor. Flair drops him on the top rope and then sends his shoulder into the steel pose for the heat. He vertical suplexes him into the ring. It's all Flair here. Bischoff makes mention, got to shoehorn this one in, the fact that as good as Ric Flair is looking right now, what does that say about our champion Hulk Hogan, who has beaten Ric Flair and beaten men like Vader?
Well, this is his way of getting Hogan over Inoki. Yeah. From thousands of miles away.
Flair applies the figure four. Inoki's able to get out of it. Flair goes to reapply it. Inoki cradles him for a two count, and this leads to Inoki making a comeback with punches, chops. Flair does his flop. He's begging off. Irish whip sends Flair into the corner, over the top to the floor. Inoki barely connects with this drop kick and gets a two count, and Bischoff acknowledges it didn't connect, but doesn't acknowledge why Flair sold it.
He also, instead of saying it barely connected, he's like, that didn't connect at all.
Didn't connect at all. Flair just took a phantom bump. There's a cartwheel kick by Inoki, and then a knee drop off the top.
Yeah.
A future Togi Makabe finish, and hits a jumping enziguri for the win at 14 minutes and 52 seconds. I thought Flair did a tremendous job in this match with a 53-year-old Antonio Inoki, I believe.
I think this is like, you know, this is the peak of Ric Flair as one type of wrestler, which is the wrestler that could work with anybody, I guess, and like... Yeah, it was like an amazing match, and this is an old man who's way past his ability to work in the ring, but Ric Flair made it look wicked.
Yeah, and afterwards, Sonny
was doing submissions, going for submissions at times.
It was a well worked main event match, very very well put together. Sonny Ono afterwards says he had no question at all regarding who was going to win,
But Inoki did take a chance by picking Ric Flair as his opponent. And then Inoki and Flair shake hands after the match. And they're trying to set up Flair wanting a rematch back in America.
Yeah.
So that was your show.
Do you think the rematch is going to happen, John?
Maybe. Time's running out. Maybe for this, if it happens again later in August, who knows?
That would be a really slow main event this time.
Flair and Inoki in 2014. Never say never in the world of pro wrestling.
Give it 20 years.
This show was okay. I didn't think it was a great show. I give it a mild 4.5 out of 10. I think you enjoyed this more than myself.
I think I enjoyed it more than you because I think, I don't know, it's hard to evaluate in terms of, like, a traditional pay-per-view because it wasn't. It was
very different.
The world's largest house show.
Which I wish also, I mean, you didn't get to see the crowd. You also didn't get to hear the crowd.
Like, no.
Apparently this crowd was just absolutely rabid. Like, it was an awesome crowd, too. Not just, you know, noise going straight up that you couldn't hear, but on this tape, it was like you really could not appreciate the crowd watching this.
Yeah, like only through Inoki's during the final match, the main event, you can kind of hear at certain points when he does a comeback, the crowd kind of like roar a little bit in the background. But yeah, it like never really comes across like the scope of that. Like 140,000 people first night, 167,000 people?
Roughly, yeah.
It's just like, yeah, that must have been, you know, like there's that point where Hawk gets up on the turnbuckle and looks into the crowd and he's doing his like face and just like, you know, just to see what that shot would have looked like, that many people staring back at you.
It would have been awesome. I just think, you know, you have that many people in one at Mayday Stadium. It's like, man.
Well, that's one thing. Also, if WWE, even WWF had this opportunity back then.
Could you have imagined?
And it would have been documented so, like we would be like right now, they would be releasing on the network, you know, the 48 hours of raw footage from their Korean trip right now. Because, like, they have just documented everything.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, maybe someone has footage of this that could make it. Because this would be like this could be a movie. Like, you know, going to North Korea with a wrestling
trip. I very much, you know, if I was more on the ball, we should have had somebody on the show this week who was on the tour. And maybe in the future we'll try and contact somebody who was on this tour because I would love to hear firsthand what it was like being on this tour from one of the American perspectives of just going into North Korea and just all the stories that you've heard of this just insane trip. Like, apparently, Ric Flair won't even talk about this tour. Like,
really?
He hated it. Just hated it.
Wow.
So,
that could be why his stuff's all shot with a camcorder then.
Maybe that's what he sensed Dan Lavransky was about to ask him.
Yeah, that was his way of cutting it off. Like, I'm not going down this road. The interview's over.
Interview's over. Well,
I do think the show, like, if I was going to give it a rating, a score, I would probably say a 6 out of 10 as far as, like, a wrestling pay-per-view.
The Nate Milton score.
Yeah, like, a nice, safe Nate.
It's worth watching. I mean, it's free. It's on YouTube. It's not on the WWE Network. It's not one of the WWE pay-per-views.
Do they own the rights to it?
Yeah.
They own the rights to it, really.
They could put it up, yeah.
Because I was wondering if there might be some weird conflict because New Japan shot the footage or maybe...
No, I mean, like, WCW aired this as a pay-per-view. Yeah. It's like they could put it up if they choose to. So go watch it. I think it's more interesting than anything.
Yeah.
Just because it's such a unique show and one that you might never see something quite like this ever again. So,
like, it's like a WrestleMania 1 type show. Like a show that's more historically important than maybe
because of the story surrounding it versus any in particular match or anything like that or an angle or anything coming out of it. All right, we have a few pieces of feedback here from those who did check it out. Christian Small writes, "This show wasn't bad by any stretch, but I feel it didn't pick up until the final two matches. I originally thought the crowd was badly mic'd until Tanay said in the main event that it was one of the first times they reacted to anything. Speaking of the commentary, I felt Bischoff was pretty good. He threw in some good insight and was the only one who tried to make it seem excited. As much as I like Tanay, he was just too plain here, and I didn't like the third guy at all. It was an example of post-commentary not working out well. In terms of ring work, nothing was bad, but the final two matches were probably the best in my view. I give the show 6 out of 10. I'll give it to Bischoff that he really tried to emphasize the importance of this show and this tour, and he was there firsthand. So on paper, it totally made sense that he would be calling this, having been one of the guys to go to North Korea. But I got to say, he was a negative on this show to me.
Well, Bischoff, like, I think his best role was you know, yeah, on screen, but like kind of as a cheerleader.
I wish it could have been Tanay and somebody else calling it, and we could have had throwing to Eric Bischoff doing taped interviews from North Korea with the different Americans before their matches.
Well, that's why
and throwing it back.
If they wouldn't let WCW bring in their own cameras or something like that. Because
I don't know. Again, I don't know the logistical situations that they might have run into, and that's totally possible. Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. All I remember from this event is Pro Wrestling Illustrated covering this like the Japanese version of WrestleMania 3. Only this drew better and had more quality matches. Flair and Inoki didn't have to be a great match in order to sell. Just a name value alone was enough for the Japanese fans to appreciate these two guys finally facing each other. Something that's missing from today's wrestling. It's almost unreal to think WCW was capable of something that big back in the day when just, well, let's not overemphasize how much WCW had to do with this show. It was minimal. Anyway, says how all right, gives the show a thumbs up, essentially.
Were there any WCW guys on the other parts of the card? Because I imagine there were other events in the show, right? Other matches in the show.
No, I mean, on both shows, it was Flair.
It's just all Flair.
It was Flair was the only officially contracted guy that WCW sent over.
Man, and that's the other thing is, like, you know, when I first heard about this pay-per-view, I was predicting, like, there's so many funny WCW wrestlers that I would love to have seen coming over there having a battle in New Japan.
Oh, man, like... God, just imagine like Buff Bagwell.
Oh, or, incredible! You know, looking back on, like, I guess it's how I felt kind of going into that ROH pay per view in Toronto, when I'm like, oh, these are great matches, but there's so many other dream matches, and this would be dream matches in a negative way with WCW and New Japan.
Tyrone writes in from Fredericton, New Brunswick. Weird seeing a clean-shaven Sonny Ono. Less of an offensive character here as well. The Joshi scene was incredible at this time with All Japan Women, Gaia, LLPW, JWP, Neo, Arsian soon to come. Brilliant women's match here. Bull Nakano, Toyota, and Akira Hokuto were in top form with Yoshida being the only to fall a little short. This is why the Steiner brothers are my favorite tag team of all time. Holy shit, they were incredible. Huge, but extremely athletic, and with lots of neat tag team combinations. The Steiner screwdriver is scary, but absolutely brilliant. Damn camera director choosing to film the Sasuke Rick brawl instead. It's the finish. Come on, man. Pretty cool giant swing spot as well from Hase. Rick is a very big man. Match of the night for me. 7 Saved by the Bell-esque Rick Steiner singlets out of 10. And final one comes from Danny Hernandez. First off, I would like to mention the signature for the network. This was broadcasting on the link you provided with dancing anime frogs was insane. If anyone has seen the Vice episode with Dennis Rodman in North Korea, knows that the cartography shown in the highlights during the show where everyone is happy and modern is anything but the case. The female tag match was awesome in my eyes compared to the women's wrestling shown today. They all moved quick with textbook perfect form. Toyota delivered a flawless German suplex during the match with the perfect bridge and pointed toes. I can see why Lita mentioned her in her Hall of Fame induction speech. Overall, a 7 out of 10 show. So there you go.
Excellent.
A Vice viewer. Those are the guys you got target, Damian.
Well, that's it. I'll tell you, I noticed, like, lately... shooting for Vice, there's a lot more people that know about Vice than I did when I was shooting for Punch Music.
Oh, I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah.
Have you seen Jim Norton's new show yet on Vice?
No, I haven't.
I haven't seen it either, but I've heard. I know the first episode had Dana White on it with Mike Tyson, and
it's on Fightland, right? It's like the Fightland.
I think so. Yeah, it's like they've done like a 4-episode like trial run, and then they might continue from there.
That's the thing, is the access is insane. Like, you know, Dana White and Mike Tyson for your first episode.
That'd be awesome.
It's just like, yeah, it's like, who else could you want?
I haven't made the emergency call yet for Dana to come in and do a show with me with, you know, Mike Tyson.
That'd be amazing.
One day. Well, Damien.
Hey, did you know this? Did you know Court Bauer worked on Black and White, the movie with Mike Tyson?
I did know that.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That is one of my favorite movies ever.
He's got quite the resume.
That is an incredible motion picture. I strongly recommend, if you're out there and have not seen it, you need to see it.
All right. Black and White.
Black and White.
Do you feel like today's podcast, that you were Ric Flair and I was Antonio Inoki? I feel like I was a zombie. I'm exhausted right now.
You carried the podcast, but I really feel like I am coming in on your hell day. Like, today's a day.
I feel like I've been a bad co-host for you.
No, not at all.
This is my second coffee of the day. I am so tired right now. Yeah. I feel like I'm going through the motion, so I apologize.
No, you need...
This is some honesty from me.
You need a herbal supplement.
That would kill me.
Some doctors have recommended this herbal supplement.
I found out that Joe Rogan did not smoke his first weed until I believe he was 29 years old.
I smoked weed until I was, from the age of 14 till about 16.
And then you stopped.
And I stopped until
I was
30.
Militant anti-weed.
I don't know. I was never militant. Like, no. I've never been in favor of prohibition of drugs. Like, I just don't think that works. But at the same time, I definitely did not understand the powers that the hippies knew about that were contained in this magic herb. But then I started – I was about 30, just about turned 31 when I first started smoking again. So Joe Rogan and I have a lot in common.
Well, you are a positive example, I think, of someone whose life has very much benefited.
Well,
that's
the thing. Like, I would never say do it. You know, like, you should do this. You should, because you never know how things are going to work out for somebody else. But I think at the same time, I'm definitely, I would describe myself now as an advocate because it has improved my well-being. So I think I'd be remiss if I didn't kind of champion it in a way. So. But, you know, like I'm fully aware that it doesn't work for everyone. So as much as I joke that you should do this, John, I only joke with you because, you know, you and I both know there's no way in hell you're going to spark up a joint after this podcast.
Not today.
Not today.
Definitely not today.
You know, I'll tell you one thing, though. Now where are all these weed wrestlers going to go without testing?
Boy, that's a scary one.
Scary one.
Is it easier for you on the road now? I would imagine being straight edge, not that you were, you know, hardcore straight edge, but I mean, there was a period of time you didn't smoke, mm-hmm. you didn't drink. Mm-hmm. Was that very difficult being, you know, just hanging out with other bands, whether that was something? Because I could imagine there'd be a lot of, like, I would imagine that if I was like that, that there'd be the constant annoyance of, what do you mean you don't drink? What do you mean you don't do this? That would just drive me nuts.
By the time we got to the point where I was touring, yeah. I think most of the people we
no
were
no one was
around.
Really hard on you and stuff
no,
like that.
No, like in high school there were the odd person.
I hated
here and
those
there.
People so much. Yeah. It was like, the fuck do you care if I smoke weed or not?
Well, because like people are all very insecure and you need that kind of reassurance that this is okay. You know, like you need with marijuana it was Dr. Sanjay Gupta being like,
yeah,
it's okay. Now it's like the New York Times
gave everyone kind of the wink, wink.
Yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
Sanjay's giving it.
Yeah,
okay.
if he's a doctor and he's saying it's okay.
Like we had Joe Rogan, we had Bill Maher, yeah. But now we got a doctor.
Yeah,
we're,
like
we're
you
solid.
Know, you, the, no one trusts the jesters; they only trust the physicians. So you know, like, but and that's what it kind of takes. But I think people just like yearn for, you know, to know that they're not alone, and if anytime they're challenged in that notion of uniformity there, it scares people, you know, and that could be like not doing drugs and not drinking, even though that's weird. It's like weird to meet someone who's threatened by that, but I think it's just because people are insecure.
I never even drank alcohol until university. Like high school, never drank.
I know. I remember you guys talking about that on the show.
And it was never like a conscious decision that I am not going to drink. It was just
you had other stuff to do.
Yeah, it was just, you know, I'd go parties and stuff and like people would drink and it was like just not really my thing or anything, but it was never, I guess it wasn't as prevalent, and then it took me a solid year before I even got used to like beer. Like I hated beer.
Oh, I hate the taste.
It was like I pretty much had to like recondition my taste buds to accept beer.
Well, that's
and
the
it
thing.
Was just horrendous
with
to try and get through one of those.
With alcohol, it's an acquired. You have to acquire a taste through.
So wine is like for me. I hate wine. Can't drink it at all.
I've tried some wines that taste really good, but for the most part, I don't taste like the taste of alcohol at all, and so I just don't drink it. And I don't really like the effects. It makes me feel sick to my stomach, so I don't drink.
I'm
in
very
Japan,
much
I will, because you can't get weed.
I went on Friday night. Our good pal Braden was having his birthday
party. Oh, absolutely.
Party.
Happy birthday, Braden.
So this was a sad night for me, not because it was Braden's birthday. I went. I had three beers at his birthday party, one of them being a bottle and two pints. And then I did a birthday shot with Braden. Felt fine. I woke up the next day, and it was like, holy Christ.
Really?
Three beers, dude. And I was fucked. I was fucked.
Did like, you have a lot of sugar? Did you eat anything?
No. There was like, I had some pizza earlier that night, but no. The shot we did with like a kamikaze.
Yeah, this was a big shot.
Does have a bit of sugar in it, but that to me was a new low. Three beers. And was hungover the next day. And it ruined like half my day just dealing with this thing.
See, that's the thing about alcohol too is there's so
it's
much.
Like I'm really at the point right now where like alcohol is really stupid. Yeah. Like I can really see the argument that like if I want to just relax, marijuana makes so much more
sense
than alcohol.
It does.
Like what? Like this is literally, we go out and it's like, I'm going to inject this poison, mm-hmm. this poison into my body, where 24 hours later, I still might have the after effects of this poison, completely unproductive the next day. I was so mad because I had so much work I had to do on the Saturday, and that's why I cut myself off at 3 beers, and still, until like 3 p.m. when it wore off, what a waste of my day. It's like alcohol to me is making a whole lot more less sense
yeah.
than ever before. Well, I enjoy drinking it, but it's stupid, well, essentially.
The thing is also, like, you're right, it's a poison, whereas we have cannabinoid receptors. Like, not to sound like Chronic from WCW, but, like, there's cannabinoids in breast milk, and that's why babies get milk drunk. They now think it's more like a milk stone mm-hmm. type thing. So we have these cannabinoid receptors. So I also can say that I've never – in this documentary, there's a day where I consume more THC than I – it's just insane the amount of THC that I consume in this one day. And it's fine. I'm fine the next day. You know, there's no hangover. There's no OD or anything like that. Like, no one's ever OD'd from weed, you know. And so,
but you made your best effort.
I really did that day. Well, like, I'll put it this way. There's cookies that, like, a really strong weed cookie that we buy would be like a 60 milligrams of THC.
Yep.
I did this one thing called Phoenix Tears, which is another type of edible, and that's 596 milligrams of THC. And we're just
you're a savage.
Oh, it was, but you know what? And you never, I still was able to host this, you know? Like, I felt great, you know, but it wasn't like, I don't know, for like it's and drug. Every drug affects everyone differently. You know, there's some people that Prozac makes them want to kill themselves, right? So I don't want to say anyone should try this and go and do this. But for me, I don't know. I just find it all it does is allow me to kind of like gain a lot more clarity. You know, so I'm not all muddled by a million different anxieties that fire in my brain at any given time. I'm just able to kind of focus on the task at hand.
It just makes me wonder if, you know, if we could change things around. Could you imagine trying to introduce alcohol, like it's this new product that has been – it's starting to get a bit of an underground movement. It's a liquid that will put you into this state of just – you don't even know what you're doing.
Yeah, you're
like you can black out from this liquid, and the next day you are so fucked from too much intake of this, and now – they're starting to sell it in stores. And now the government is going to have specific stores to make money off of it.
And they're
going to
make so much money.
There is no way.
No.
And this thing can alter your senses. And people are getting behind their cars and cannot function anymore. Like, can you imagine trying to pitch alcohol today?
Or even like
as a consumer.
Look at the violence associated with alcohol. You know, you're like, you just be like, there's this, yeah, like you said, like there's this stuff. It's like water, but it tastes horrible and it makes you want to fight and it makes you do bad things and it makes you do
crazy. We tried it in this one country and here are the drinking and driving fatalities. Here are the stats. And now we're going to bring this into Canada, into the U.S. Not a chance. There is not a fucking chance this thing gets greenlit.
But alcohol is such a part of – that's also the only issue with being straight edge I found was the fact that alcohol is such a part of
– it's normalized.
Our society.
It's completely normalized.
Like, the idea of not taking a drink is insulting in some places. You
sure.
know, in some situations. Like you'll be in – that's the one thing about not being straight edge now. I'll now can take a sip of alcohol rather than have to explain to the person. Like, no, I'm not trying to offend you. I just don't drink, so your shot is wasted on me.
And what's the response? It's a weird look.
Oh, like what?
Don't drink.
Yeah, like in Russia, like trying to explain to someone why you don't drink vodka. It's like, well, you got to understand, like there's this Ian MacKaye. He was the singer of this band Minor Threat in D.C. Well, it actually goes back longer than that. Jonathan Richman. You know, so I'm trying to explain this to someone. Whereas now I'm just like, okay, I'll just take a sip of this alcohol and then be fine with it.
What a phenomenon.
It is such part of our culture and part of our society.
Totally. Like, beer is not a – it's just associated with having a – and listen, hey, you can enjoy alcohol
absolutely.
Moderately and no one will have any problems with it.
The only drug that I've never heard or seen anyone be able to enjoy moderately are opiates. You know, those are the drugs that no one really enjoys those moderately. So don't enjoy those moderately. But anything else, like if you can find a way to – function with your life without hurting anyone else and enjoy your whatever given excuse to get away from reality, enjoy it. You know, like I would never tell anyone what to do or not to do. I had a way more destructive record addiction than any drug addiction.
Well, that's
spending thousands of dollars on records.
You joke about that, but that to me was always One thing with me is that I feel I have a very addictive personality when it comes to things that, you know, interests I have. It's like I don't just casually get into something. I just become obsessed with it.
Jersey Shore podcast.
Sure. Jersey Shore. Dude, coffee, for instance. Okay. I like never needed it, never liked it. And then all of a sudden, like, hooked on it. And I always thought, man, it's like I always knew that if I started smoking cigarettes, I knew I would be hooked on them. Mm. I knew that I would be one of those guys that would need to smoke 3 cigarettes a day, and it would just have to be part of my day. So I was like, I'm never going to fucking smoke a cigarette because I know what it's going to lead to. It has nothing to do with willpower. I will tap out every single time. Yeah. And that to me was always my biggest deterrent, was I knew I would – it would not just be, oh, I smoke every now and then.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the thing is like there are certain drugs that you can try. And that can be every now and then. There's certain drugs that you try and they change your body chemistry. And so like cigarettes are one of them. Opiates are one of them where your body just reconfigures itself so it needs those drugs from now on. So then you – it's much harder to refuse to take it even using all your willpower. I don't know. I've never wanted to smoke. Coffee's never interested me. Booze, not so much. Though I would love to get – I think maybe if I got drunk enough, I could understand the appeal of Jason Agnew and Braden singing those karaoke songs.
Oh.
You know, you go out there with those
guys.
Oh,
I still don't get it. Oh, you don't get it? I don't get it either. Don't worry. Alcohol.
I know you hate karaoke, but I just like, oh, man, they seem to love it, though.
They do.
What's next is a great – it's an opportunity for me to see a lifestyle that I didn't even know existed.
Oh, yeah. Karaoke fans. An entire culture.
It's an entire culture. Totally different culture. It's a very, very interesting call. I'm being exposed to a lot of different music on that podcast, too, that I've never listened to.
It's a door into their lives.
But it's weird how you intersect with people. Like the Planet Smashers is a band that I grew up listening to, too.
There anyway, you go. You look for your parallel crossing points.
I digress. All you want to do, you're just having visions of what the hell is Bobby Roode going to do now, dancing in your head. And No.
I enjoyed this conversation the most because it turns the brain off.
It turns the brain off.
The drug and narcotics talk has ended.
Well, at least we saved it for the end.
We consciously spaced it out. You guys have been front-loading it. We had a little opening about TV shows.
That's true.
Trying to navigate. You can't make everybody happy.
No, but you know what? Like, and who, people that complain about that stuff, like, you know, even when you're talking to Nate about sports, like, I'm not a sports fan, but like, that's part of the podcast. You can fast forward. Just fast forward it like people do those promotions on the podcast ones. That
you know what? You know what I always liken our podcast to? It's like if I gave you a canister of paint and I asked you to throw it onto the wall. Your goal is not to cover the entire wall. That's impossible. True. But I'm going to try and hit as much of it as I can with one swing of the paint.
And I would gladly hear someone telling me about, you know, sports one time or talking about MMA, like some big headline in MMA another time, then hearing someone tell me how much I can make in one day playing fantasy sports every single time I listen to their podcast. Which
I've never gone into fantasy sports.
Have you – you know that ad I'm talking about on all the podcast one?
Oh! If it's not connected. Yeah,
if it's not JR telling me about how much his friends have made from playing fantasy sports, it's Steve Austin. I'm like, whoa, this is popular amongst wrestling
people. I guess so, man. Fantasy sports and buying new cars.
Yeah, new cars. And
Audible.com, berries, that's a big one.
Sherry's Berries.
Another one. All right, we're hitting delirium. So we're going to wrap this up.
At least mine is induced by a substance. Yours is induced by sheer amount of work.
Just lack of sleep. It's fine.
And lack of whey.
Lack of whey. Yeah, that's true.
Am I the last one with that whey? Oh, no.
He was back on Monday.
Yeah.
But
I'm the last one with that way.
As we established in real time, you are show number one on Monday, and I've got 2 more shows today to do.
So you would say I'm the headliner.
You are getting me ready to tackle the rest of the day. There's no one else I could kick out the day with than you.
Like, yeah, that's true. I'm glad it was me and not, you know, some jerk that wrestles in UFC that's infinitely more popular than me as a guest host.
Damien, you are very high up the food chain.
Yeah, that's what you keep telling me, John, but I don't believe it.
Hey,
I don't believe it, buddy.
There's no other person who I've seen a sold-out show at in Toronto than you that has co-hosted this podcast.
That's true.
That was a rabid audience, and there was no opener. They were there for you and your band.
Didn't Tom Lawlor fight on the Toronto card? No?
He's fought in Montreal.
Toronto. That was probably sold out.
Yeah. Wasn't the headliner, though.
Oh, boom. Thanks, John. That's awesome. No, thanks,
I got
Sean.
You're back.
Yeah, number one. Number one.
All right, we're going to wrap this up. Next week's review away, I'm going to let Mr. Ting decide what he wants to review. So tune in to Review and Impact
we
on
should
Thursday
let,
night.
You should let me decide and then force you guys both to watch what I decide to, for you guys to watch.
Well,
Boy Meets World, Jake the Snake Roberts, Big Van Vader episode. Done.
We'll let Mr. Ting decide on Thursday what he wants to – he might be completely – off the grid after this trip to California. Maybe he's had a life-altering moment about wrestling, and he's going to want to review today's special.
No, that means the Superior Spider-Man's going to come back and be the new podcast on Thursdays.
Oh, that could be. Review a spider.
Review a Spidey.
Fantastic ideas that we are coming up with here.
I tell you, we should be filling up these slots at networks.
Is there anything you want to let our listeners know about? Where can we catch you?
Check out the
road trip to Brazil.
If you're in Brazil, this Saturday I'm playing at some venue that I was going to look up on my phone, but there's no way I remember. And if you're so inclined, check out Canadian Cannabis, the documentary, next week coming out on Vice.com. I'm sure we'll have some information about that. And shout out to all the listeners I got to meet on tour and all the listeners that, hopefully I'll meet in the near future. And thank you again, John and Wei, wherever you are, for doing this podcast.
Next time, we'll have the three of us.
Well, we need the three of us where no one has anything to do and one of the major companies hasn't gone bankrupt or seemingly gone bankrupt the night before.
I'm going to sleep 12 hours before we do our next one.
Exactly.
I guarantee you.
I'm going to smoke 12 ounces before we do the next
one. Oh, my goodness. This is the makings of something huge.
It's going to be
here.
Huge. And then I'm going to fight Tom Lawler for the co-host spot.
All right, everyone. Go up to liveaudiowrestling.com. Follow at Left for Damien. And here we go to wrap up this wonderful edition of Review Away.
Today's special, shout it out with cheer.
Hurry, Jody. Got to make it before 999.
I hope she makes it there in time.
Hurry, Jody, get there.
I hope she gets there before 999.
I hope she gets there before 9. Clock keeps on ticking, it keeps on ticking, she has so very little time, she has so very little time. Hurry, Jody, get there.
I hope she gets there before 9999.
I hope she gets there before 9. Now don't get caught in traffic, don't get caught in traffic. That really would be such a crime. And Jody's running out of time. Hurry, Jody, get there.
I hope she gets there before 9999.
I hope she gets there before 9. I wonder how she's doing. How she's doing. It's getting very, very late. It's getting very, very late.